I'm going to declare that it's 10 o'clock, resumption of the FRM hearing, so-called, called by the New Hampshire Secretary of State pursuant to his order dated October 5th, 2010. We are adjourning this morning. I'm Charles Chandler, the presiding officer here, our attorneys from the Bureau of Securities Regulation. We do have some preliminary matters this morning. Attorney Forcier, do you have some matters?
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. I have for you a memorandum of interview of Christopher Carter, interviewed by Richard Head and Christopher Marshall of the Attorney General's Office. This is the one interview memorandum that I asked you to hold back so we can add some additional documentation with it. I have with that a November 29, 2010 interview transcript between myself, Mr. Jeffrey Spill, and Chris Carter. We interviewed him on November 29th at his office in regards to the FRM matter, and I transcribed that recording tape.
Okay. Recalling that the technical rules of evidence do not apply to this hearing, I'm going to accept these two documents. I have reviewed them. I find them acceptable and probative. I'm going to ask that they be marked independently.
Okay. So the exhibit 94 and 95.
94 is an interview of Chris Carter dated March 17, 2010. 95 is going to be an interview of attorney Chris Carter dated November 29, 2010.
I have here a statement by Jeffrey Spill and myself regarding Mr. Carter's contacts with the Security Bureau. We discovered that he did, in fact, call the Bureau and spoke with Jonas Cutler, a prior employee. Mr. Spill and myself had a conversation with Mr. Cutler, and this is an accurate memorandum talking about what Mr. Cutler told us about that contact.
So you're offering that letter as an offer of proof of your conversation with Mr. Cutler relative to Mr. Carter's contact with the Bureau. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay, I'll accept that also. That'll be 96. I've seen that also.
I personally reviewed Mr. Spill's phone logs for a two-year period, all of 2003 and 2004, because it was alleged that many contacts were made to Mr. Spill, or at least a couple of contacts during that time period by Mr. Carter. I reviewed the phone log. Mr. Spill keeps a phone log since he began working in the Bureau for 9 years or so now, and I reviewed the two-year period, which was overly broad. It was about a two-month period where Mr. Carter alleged in our interview that he contacted the Jeffrey Spill himself. I did a two-year period just to make sure there was no, no contact, and I didn't find any contact. And I pretty much wrote that and signed that.
This short document represents a statement of your findings on the research relative to the phone log of Attorney Spill. Is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Okay. You're going to offer today, under seal, the phone log of Attorney Spill for, I believe, a two-month period of time in which, purportedly, Attorney Carter felt that he had contacted Attorney Spill. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Exactly.
Okay. And let the record reflect that I have reviewed that phone log, and it is under seal because there are obviously multiple contacts from many individuals which would be totally inappropriate for it to be divulged into the public forum. I will accept both of those documents, one the obvious under seal. No, I think these ought to be two because this is a two-month log and this is a report of findings on a two-year. So let's have these be two separate ones.
Mr. Chandler, we hadn't previously discussed this, but I would like to offer my legislative testimony. The reason being was quite a bit of controversy surrounding the stone matter and National Inspection and Repair and the various problems that posed to try and sort it out. And I realize you have my statement before the Attorney General when they did their report. However, that's their rendition. That's what they put put down their rendition of what I said. I believe that my legislative testimony has more detail to it.
Your legislative testimony was under oath?
No, it was not.
It was not. But you are a member of the bar?
Correct.
Okay, and therefore an officer of the court?
Correct.
You're going to represent to me that everything in the legislative testimony is fair and accurate to the best of your knowledge and belief?
Yes, absolutely.
Under those conditions, I'll accept that.
Thank you. And I think it would be helpful for you to just kind of flesh out a little bit better of, you know, what my view was of the whole thing.
Okay.
Of those matters.
So let's mark this as in the next sequence.
I have before me testimony of Mike Delaney, Richard Head, and Michael Krebs. We spoke off the record about your desire to have this as part of the record, their testimonies of the Joint Legislative Committee, and I have them here.
Yes,
two different days, June 21st and May 21st.
I did request that. Once again, do you know if those people were under oath in that testimony?
Judging by Mr. Spill's answer, I guess not.
To the best of your knowledge, are they all members of the New Hampshire Bar?
To the best of my knowledge, yes.
Okay. I'm going to accept those, and I did, for the record, I did ask for those.
And there are some additional people's testimony in here, but I wanted to give you the whole day. Just to
Yep, I understand that.
That's Exhibit 100.
Those can be joined, yeah.
I also have a financial resources video, commercial loan training video, I guess I would call it, and it was copyrighted in 05 and just found it to be informative on FRM's business model. And I offer that for the record.
I'm going to accept that, but I want the record to show that I have reviewed that. I don't find it all that informative. I don't find it all that probative, and I don't find it of any great value, but I'm going to offer it on the record, if nothing else, for demeanor.
That's all I have for preliminary matters.
That's quite all right. I can... Okay. Yeah, let's just label that a training video or
okay.
Something. There being no other preliminary matters, I see that our first witness is a Mr. Kurt Gillies. Is Mr. Gillies here? Mr. Gillies, if you wish, please come forward and take a seat. Mr. Gillies, as you undoubtedly know, these proceedings are being recorded. They are public. People may come and go. If you choose to testify this morning in this matter, you will be testifying under oath. Do you understand that to be the case?
I do.
Okay. Would you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Mr. Gillies, many individuals who have come before this hearing process have had prepared statements that they have read into the record. Others have not had prepared statements and have spoken extemporaneously about their relationship in the FRM matter. Do you have a prepared statement this morning?
I do not have a prepared statement, Mr. Chandler.
Would you like to offer any kind of an extemporaneous opening statement? You don't have to. Don't feel obligated to in any way.
Well, I'd like to first...
Please do that. Please proceed.
Thank you for asking me to appear today. I hope my intent is to provide some information to the hearing that may be of importance and assistance in achieving your goals. And I'm prepared this morning to discuss matters that I've already been involved with talking with these two gentlemen here, and
I'm going to ask you to suspend for a minute. Anybody having difficulty hearing back there?
Yes.
I'll have to speak a little louder.
I'm going to ask you to speak up because I don't know of any way we can.
Okay.
Or maybe if you sat over in that chair, you could project a little bit better this way.
Yeah, let's try that, Mr. Gillies. Would you sit on the end over here and. That might help.
Okay.
But please resume, Mr. Gillies.
Well, as I was saying, my intent is to assist the hearing in its goals to establish what the circumstances were regarding our FRM. That's all I have to say, sir.
Okay. Well, do you gentlemen want to start with questioning?
Sure.
Okay. Attorney Spill.
Could you give us, Mr. Gillies, your educational background, starting with college and then your work history post-college?
Sure. I completed a Bachelor of Arts in History, as well as a Bachelor of Science in Business Administration, concurrently graduating from the University of New Hampshire, class of 79. Also completed a degree in the German language at the University of Salzburg, Austria in 1978. Subsequently, I completed a master's degree in accounting at New Hampshire College Graduate School of Business here in Manchester. It's now known as Southern New Hampshire University. Graduated in 1996. Work history. I've essentially been an accountant and an auditor my entire working career. I started working as a staff accountant for Concord Litho Company here in Concord, New Hampshire for 4 years, from like 1980 to 84, and then joined the United States Army. And I've been in the Army ever since, a 26-year veteran at this point in time. Non-commissioned officer. I've been in military intelligence for a number of decades. I have a top secret clearance and a number of other attributes which I'm not at liberty to discuss. Further, I worked for Manufacturers Hanover Trust Bank and subsequently the merger with Chemical Bank, New York City Money Center Bank, working here in the New Hampshire offices in the Consumer Services Division. I worked with them for about 7 years, from 1987 to the end of 93. I then joined Meredith Village Savings Bank, working there as an auditor in the Lakes region for about 2 years, and then finally joining the New Hampshire Banking Department in the late summer of 1995. I was employed by the department until I resigned in June of 2007. I should add, prior to June 2007, I believe it was February 2006, I received orders from United States Army mobilizing me to participate in Operation Iraqi Freedom. It was an 18-month combat tour, which I performed. I was on active duty for about 2 years, from 06 to early 08, end of 08, excuse me, March, the end of March 08. And at that point in time, I elected to take a job as it was offered to me as an auditor, examiner with the New Hampshire State Insurance Department. And that's where I'm currently employed.
Since I'm going to be asking you a series of questions about your audit function with the New Hampshire Banking Department, and many of the questions are going to be related to auditing and examining books and records.
Yes.
I'd like to have you explain a little bit more about what your duties were with Manufacturers Trust and the Meredith Village Savings.
Okay. Right. I was involved in collections initially. And credit analysis, as well in consumer service loans. This included student loans and so on and so forth. I then worked for Meredith Village Savings Bank as an internal auditor, reporting administratively to the president of the bank and operationally to the audit committee of the board of directors of the bank. When I joined the New Hampshire Banking Department, I went through a pretty rigorous training program that was set up and administered by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation in Washington, D.C. I attended a long list of courses there, as well as with the Federal Reserve Board, as well as with other professional organizations, mortgage organizations, and so on, for training purposes. There must have been at least 20 courses that I took over the course of my career at the banking department.
What's your current capacity?
I work as a junior examiner, actually, for the insurance department. The insurance industry is actually quite different from banking. We are looking at financial statements, essentially, and operations pursuant to the solvency of the entity that we're looking at. Whereas in banking, you're always trying to determine the safety and soundness of the entity under examination.
So I believe you testified that you started with the banking department in 1995?
Right.
And what was your title?
Bank trainee, bank examiner trainee, actually.
So if you could take us to, from like 1995 to the year 2000, can you describe your duties for us, and if there were examination duties, what the examinations entailed?
Yes. First of all, let me say, to qualify for the job, underwent a pretty rigorous vetting process. Had to take a test. To qualify for the job, you had to have a degree in accounting, which I did. You further had to undergo a interview held by individuals at the banking department, and they asked a series of very pointed questions, as I recall. Then, following further review, you were asked, or may not be asked, to return for a second interview, which I did. And finally, after about 50 people went through this process, four of us were selected and offered a job, and four of us were hired. I knew the deputy commissioner, Alan Genot. He was an old family friend. He knew my reputation and knew who I was and my background, so on and so forth. He'd asked me twice before to join the department. At first, I declined. I chose to work in Meredith Village Savings Bank. The other opportunity I had was to relocate to Manhattan, work in the tax department of the bank, but my family didn't really want to move to New York, so I elected to stay here. But the second time he asked me, I said okay. So that's when I took the test, went through the interview process, and joined the department. Initially, I went along as part of an examination team to examine state chartered banks and depository institutions. The first 4 years I was there, I went through, as I mentioned to you, a series of professional courses with the FDIC and a number of other institutions to get the training required to perform the job. At the same time, the banking department had actually two divisions. There was a bank division, if you will, and there was a consumer credit division. The time I was hired, there was only one examiner, George Harrington, in the bank, in the consumer credit division. And the department, the division chief and her assistant, were keen to expand the examination of a large, what at that time already was a pretty large number of institutions that were engaged in consumer credit activities and hadn't really been closely scrutinized to that point. So they wanted to have someone in there who was familiar with consumer services and could hit the ground running, so to speak. So I engaged in those types of activities also, those types of examinations. And after about 4 years or so, I was asked to decide whether I really wanted to work full-time, if you will, on the bank side or on the consumer credit side. I chose to go to the consumer credit side. It seemed to be the area where the most growth and challenge was going to be. And that's how I started down that path.
What types of entities were audited on the consumer credit side of the banking department?
There were first mortgage and second mortgage bankers and brokers. These are entities that offer services related to residential mortgages, consumer mortgages. Also, there were sales finance companies. These are entities that provide financing for the purchase or lease of motor vehicles here in New Hampshire. We also had retail entities called retail sellers. These are essentially car dealerships that have a license to act as a go-between, that is between the consumer who's seeking to purchase or lease a vehicle and the lender who would provide the financing to purchase or lease that vehicle. So in essence, they have an F&I shop, as they call it, in-house, and they have credit applications there. They have a means to check your credit score, some means to preliminarily see if that individual will qualify to get money to purchase or lease that vehicle. We also had small lenders. These are lenders who are engaged in also financial instruments to purchase some sort of consumer item. And pursuant to the statute, they'd have to have a license depending on what type of activity that was. Later on, the laws changed and we were tasked with taking a look at what became known as title loan companies. These are entities that in essence were asking you to submit a title to your vehicle, which had to be held by you free and clear, in an effort to borrow relatively small amounts of money for purportedly short-term periods of time to meet some financial need. Later, we also were tasked with taking a look at check cashing entities. These are places that you could go and cash checks for a fee and so on. And I think there are even more, maybe check transmitter companies, or Western Union type place. Those are the types of entities, Mr. Spill, that we were tasked with overseeing.
With respect to the first mortgage bankers and brokers, was safety and soundness something that you would look for in an examination?
Clearly, the statute called for trying to establish the financial integrity of the entity that you were examining. Along with that, we would look at the operational activities and see whether the entity that was under examination was in compliance with the very many state statutes as well as applicable federal statutes, see they were in compliance with the Code of Administrative Rules, any interpretive opinions that may be applicable. There was a real alphabet soup and alphanumeric series of laws that needed to be or could be applied to these various entities, the first mortgage bankers and brokers, to see that they were indeed operating in conformity with the law.
How about capital adequacy? Was that a concern when you did an examination?
Capital adequacy would also be a concern. This would be, in essence, a strong sign of the health of a company. We always tried to look for the strongest set of financial statements that we could obtain from that entity without creating too much of a burden, financial burden, cost burden on that entity to provide those sets of financial statements. So this could range anywhere from an audit to a review to a compilation to even an in-house set of financial statements that would have been compiled by their in-house accounting staff, bookkeeping staff. And we take a look at that to see that there was positive net worth there. An additional factor that came into play was their need, if there were any questions about the financials, if you will, of a company, We'd always ask for a bond be posted. I think, as I recall, for the first Mortgage Bankers and Brokers, that was about $100,000, a surety bond payable to the state of New Hampshire, and we'd have to have that on file, and it would have to be an annually renewable item. So if, for example, there were some questions about, you know, how much cash, I mean, the threshold was you had to have a $100,000 net worth. This was liquid net worth. 365 days a year. Not that, you know, the day we look at fiscal year end 12/31 or wherever it may be, you know, you had $100,000 cash in the bank and the next day, you know, it's cut in half. You had to have something that was in place for that entire licensing period, which typically was a year. And so if there were questions arising, as I remember, regarding the those financials, a bond would be asked to be posted, either in the full amount or at least an amount necessary to meet that $100,000 minimum threshold.
In this time period, 1995 to, say, 2000, early 2000s, what was happening in the mortgage industry?
Rapid expansion. The number of licensees, as I recall, I kept track of on a spreadsheet of the number of licensees and each of the, you know, types of licensees that the state offered or required to have. And you saw a dramatic growth, at least doubling, tripling even, within that 10-year period of time. The economy, wider economy, was good and was growing by leaps and bounds. And I saw, in essence, a lot of larger banks either setting up their own mortgage companies to deal with what, in essence, were, you know, bread and butter type lending instruments, because they were going after more profitable areas within the bank itself. So you have these spin-offs, these mortgage licensees, bankers, brokers, as well as the independents. I'm not saying they were all, you know, under control, or their parent companies were banks. Many were not. This was clearly an area of growth and of a growing concern, because as I attended various conventions and so on, meetings with other colleagues from other states throughout the country, there was always an element of potential fraud there. And as time went on, I got more involved with that kind of examination, that type of activity, and I ultimately did engage in a number of examinations that did result in cooperation with the Attorney General's Office, Department of Safety, the Real Estate Office. Ultimately, one even ended up with a federal district attorney.
The entities that you just listed earlier, First Mortgage, Banker Broker, Sales Finance, Retail Sellers, Small Lenders, Title Loan Companies, were they all licensed by the Banking Department?
The vast majority of them were. Sometimes we would find or hear about an entity that was operating without a license, and sometimes that was found to be true.
Okay. Was there some personnel changes occurring around this time period?
Well, as I mentioned to you earlier, we started with a very small staff. Ultimately, that was doubled, and two more people were brought on board who worked with us in the Consumer Credit Division. Commissioner Roberge passed away in the summer of 2001, and for a short time we were without both a commissioner and a deputy commissioner, because Deputy Commissioner Janot had retired some 18 months previously, but his position had remained unfilled. So the governor saw fit to bring Mr. Janot out of retirement, make him commissioner pro tem until a permanent individual could be found to fill the position. That individual was Peter Hildreth. He joined the department sometime in the fall, as I recall, or late summer of 01. And there were a number of senior positions to fill, because general counsel had left. The chief bank examiner's position was also vacant, and Gene Dobbins, who had been chief examiner, left for the private sector. A number of senior bank examiners had left too, in recent period leading up to that for other opportunities. So there were a number of key positions that were needed to be filled, and actually my boss's boss, the division head, division chief, if you will, Kathleen Belanger, was in many respects acting as like deputy commissioner in the absence of anyone there. When Mr. Hildreth came on board, he did seek to fill these other positions in due course, and we had a number of new people come join the department from outside the department who I didn't know, but apparently many of them had worked with Mr. Hildreth previously in some capacity or other. Also, we were asked to take a hard look at how we were conducting examinations on the consumer credit side of the house. And at that time, I recall working with one of my colleagues to, or two of my colleagues, to put together an examination format that would be much more formalized than what it had been, and address that that requirement. We did that, and came up with what I thought was a good model for what we were looking at, included analysis of financial condition, operational matters, compliance issues, and so on and so forth. But concurrent to that, Mr. Hildreth and Ms. Gerda, who was at that point the division chief, decided to hire a lot more new people and new examiners, and they were brought in. However, I guess the conditions have changed of hiring such that these people weren't, you know, accountants per se. They were bright young individuals out of college. Many of them had almost no work experience. Many of them did have business backgrounds, but and again, as opposed to the way I was trained when I was in the department, that is going through specific FDIC schools, Federal Reserve schools, programs of that nature, these individuals were not provided that opportunity. They were told they were going to be trained on the job. They would go to other, you know, specific mortgage schools that were offered by professional organizations around the country. As well, just when we thought we were going to, you know, implement this new, or formalized, I should say, more formalized way of examining consumer credit entities, we were told that that was unacceptable, and we were going to embark on a program of a massive increase of examinations. So instead of doing 60, 70 exams a year, we would embark on a program where we were doing hundreds.
And when was that change?
That's a good question. I would venture to say it was sometime in the late part of 02, 2000, late 02. As I best recollect.
Did the methods by which you examined around that time period, 2002, change from the earlier time period?
They certainly changed to the degree that we were no longer looking at these entities in the depth that we had previously. And embarked on a program where in essence, you were in and out of a company within a matter of days instead of what had been, say, weeks. Depending on the size and the scope of the exam, I mean, there were a number of factors that went into determining how long that was going to be for and what exactly we were going to look at. But this was true for all entities. So whether it was, you know, Countrywide Mortgage, which was the nation's largest non-depository mortgage lender, ultimately, or some small local broker who was operating out of his home, it was a very abbreviated exam. and what I call drive-by examinations in reference to these types of appraisals that can be done at times. Yeah. I asked, you know, why this was being done, and I was, because the statute had not changed. I guess the interpretation of the statute had changed, not by me, but by Mr. Hildreth and the senior leadership there. As a result, apparently, of concerns brought to the attention of the department by the LBA during a recent audit that effectively, I guess, not enough entities were being examined.
Let me interrupt for a minute. For the record, LBA, you mean Legislative Budget Assistance.
I do, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you.
Do you have any expertise in the area of forensic examination or fraud analysis?
I do have some expertise there. I was able to take some courses while I was at the department and also work with my supervisors as well as work with attorneys at the Attorney General's office in a coordinated effort and in an attempt to identify some of the more problematic licensees. And we were successful in a number of cases. I'm very, pretty proud of that. And that was the way I kind of stumbled into this, I guess. I mean, because of the nature of the entities, of some of the entities that we were working with or looking at, we did find some pretty disagreeable characters as well as questionable practices that did ultimately come to be litigated. And again, as I said, I worked with the Attorney General's office, Walter Maroney there, Chris Carter there, David Rienzo there, Brian Tierney there, he was the CPA, individuals at the Department of Safety too. I was encouraged to seek out and talk to these other folks in instances where we needed some assistance or at least needed some cooperation to try to get done what we felt needed to be done. This was always under the direction, of course, of my supervisors, which earlier had been Raymond Hero and Kathleen Belanger. That type of cooperation ceased under Mr. Hildreth's administration, and I was told at some point orally not to speak with other agencies without first going through Ms. Gerda or Mr. Hildreth or Mr. Fleury. And that was a change. Also, we had hired, prior to Mr. Hildreth coming on board, an attorney for the division to help with these legal matters, because I'm not a lawyer by trade, didn't have the background, the skill necessary to write up briefs and so on and so forth. So an attorney was hired, and we did have a number of hearings and a number of cases where we pursued some administrative hearing or litigation to bring someone to task. She was released, or she resigned, shortly after Mr. Hildreth came on board. Subsequently, another attorney came in, Ms. Boudreau, Andrea Boudreau. And eventually I was, or at some point in time, after Mr. Hildreth was hired, I was just put on task of doing these regularly scheduled examinations. As I mentioned to you, we embarked on this program of massive expansion of doing exams, and that really became the focus, the need for our time to be spent training new people on the job as well as getting these examinations done. So to the extent possible and within the time we were given, get them done. So for a number of years, I did just that. And then subsequently, I think it was sometime in 04, late 04 or so, summer, late summer or early fall, shortly before I did my first exam at FRM, I was, Deputy Fleury had been able to get the senior leadership to agree that I should be part again of taking a look at some of these potentially problematic entities and working with Ms. Boudreaux in that regard to do these special examinations. And that was with the agreement of Donna Susi, who was the general counsel at the time, Ms. Boudreaux, Deputy Fleury, and Division Chief Jurda. I met in their room, or her, Jurda's room, and they congratulated me. And so at that point, I was, again, wearing a dual hat, if you will, doing regularly scheduled examinations, working with other examiners to make sure they're trained and led, as well as doing these special type examinations.
Does Andrea Boudreaux also go by the name of Andrea Shaw?
I understand she does. I believe she got married. I think her husband is an attorney, as I remember.
With respect to the increase in the number of exams that you had to perform, was there a way in which the examiners would tackle that?
Well,
was there a system devised?
What entities were going to be examined really came to be held in the hands of my supervisors. I was no longer free to, like, you know, pick and choose which entities looked worthy of examination, at least under the old system. And so I just got my marching orders and went out and did the exam.
Was there a tier process that was put in place?
Well, the tier process that we had been working under previous to this change and embarkation on greatly expanded number of examinations to be conducted, that the tier process was like a four-tier, in essence, process whereby, because, again, of staff limitations, keep in mind this is the days when we had, you know, like four examiners to do thousands of examinations. We would identify in Tier 1 the largest entities that were doing the most amount of business in New Hampshire. They were doing the most amount of lending on a dollar volume basis. The second tier were also entities that were pretty significant, maybe were new licensees, entities we didn't have had a chance to look at in the past, but we wanted to take a closer look at their activities. So that was the second tier. And then the third tier were entities that we received complaints about or that we had suspicions about, or we had, you know, some cause from another agency, you know, we heard that we got a referral or something, caused us to take a real hard look at what was going on. These were the potential troubling entities. But the fourth tier I might allude to was, in essence, a process whereby during the licensing renewal and application process, we would have examiners called in off the road or in-house to take a look at these applications, either as new applicants or as renewal applicants, and see whether they were going to get a license or not. And in essence, we were asking, I think, what would be considered typically more information than normal than other states would ask for that kind of information. This was in an effort to meet the statutory requirement that all of these entities be, quote-unquote, examined. And this has been the system that had been in place since I was hired up until Mr. Hildreth and Ms. Jurda, and our senior management there, decided to embark on a whole new approach.
What was the new approach?
Again, doing a massive number of examinations, far more in the hundreds. You know, we hired more new people. I think we effectively quadrupled our staff. I think we went from like four examiners to 12, if I'm not mistaken, 10 or 12.
Is there anything that in particular that sticks out in your mind with respect to this new way of auditing in terms of the methods used? Earlier you had mentioned the use of funneling documents to counsel for the entities, and I think you had mentioned a drive-by.
Yeah, well, if you go to a large company, you know, a big mortgage company, operates nationwide, all 50 states, doing thousands of loans, and you really want to understand how that entity is going to operate, you're not going to find that out in the course of a few days. You really have to spend some significant period of time, more than one examiner, say, three examiners even, taking a look at different aspects of the entity. And that started to change. So, you know, when I was going out, and I think most people going out, there were just one or two of us looking at a particular entity for a very short period of time and coming up with like a two or three page report of examination instead of what traditionally, I mean, I always had, you know, 10, 12 page examination.
How many exams did you have ongoing at a particular period?
Well, I can't say definitively because I wasn't in charge of scheduling. But I do know every single examiner was out on the road all the time. Very rarely were we in-house, maybe to come in and put together the final report of exam and then pass it in and have it edited and so on, make those corrections, and you're back out on the road doing another exam.
Did the tier mechanism for examination, did that go away at some point?
Yeah, we basically dropped that entirely.
So was it more?
I'm not saying we didn't look at, you know, the entities that used to be part of the tier. It's just that we were looking at all entities, all licensees. With a mind to getting in there, looking at what we were directed had to be looked at, and writing up a report of exam and getting out.
So was the goal to examine all licensees in a certain period of time?
I think as many as possible, yeah. The goal was to examine hundreds. I mean, as I remember, they were like, boy, some 1 year or so, there was at least, there were like 900 entities examined. I think. Maybe wrong. Maybe I may be completely off there. I just remember we were going into, you know, completely uncharted waters, and in a manner that, in my professional opinion, would not really be sufficient to come up with the results of what I would consider a good report of examination. You know, there'd be an ROE here, but. Whether it was really thorough or not, no. You certainly can compare it to the bank side.
Now, this new role that you're placing with respect to your fraud examinations, how did that fit into your regular duties in the regular format of examination?
After a time when I started working with Andrea, she would get a complaint, make up a file, have a brief in there about what the details were, have me follow up with it, see if it's worth, you know, pursuing. I communicated with her regularly on this, so I would have, you know, up to 12, maybe 15 complaints on my desk at any one time. At the same time, if something came in, like the FRM case came in, that was introduced to me not as a written complaint. Ms. Boudreaux approached me and orally said, "There's this company up in the Lakes region, and I'd like you to go do an examination of them. And these are some of the particulars." They were talking about, and she said that it had come to her from, the complaint had come to her from an employee who had quit working there, and she was concerned about their practices, and that, especially the custody of documents that weren't properly handled. And they would be put in bags and thrown in the dumpster, and bears would come out of the woods and tear these things up, and the stuff was paperwork was flying all over the paper, all over the parking lot, and in the woods.
Time frame.
And so I didn't see anything in writing, but I did go with a junior examiner to do what we would call a regularly scheduled examination. We were there for about a week.
What was the time frame?
I remember being there for at least a week.
And in what year?
October of 04.
You have in front of you a bank examination?
I do.
I'd like to provide a copy of that to the hearings officer.
I may have that.
I'm gonna walk them through this so you may find it instructive to follow along. When you went up there in October of 04, did you conduct an examination?
I did.
And I think you said, correct me if I'm wrong, that the reason you were sent up there was because there was a complaint about papers going on the parking lot?
That and the fact that I think, you know, they were due for a regularly scheduled examination anyway.
And this was financial resources and assistance of the Lakes Region, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Can you kind of walk us through the examination that you did? And
I remember Mr. contacted the company to let them know we were coming, sent them some kind of a letter, a first day letter, if you will, indicating under what legal right we were going to be there and what we were going to be looking for. I remember going up there, meeting with the office manager. At some point, President Farah was introduced to us, and we spoke with him. And we proceeded to try to gather the documents and so on that we needed to conduct the exam, as well as speak with various individuals pertaining to the examination.
What did you do to follow up on the complaint of respect to the papers?
Relative to that, I asked both the office manager and Mr. Farah whether I asked them about the custody of documentation that was submitted to them pursuant to obtaining a mortgage loan or any of the other activity types of loans that they were licensed for. They explained that to me, and they said ultimately if the loan was denied or it became inactive, it was no longer an active file. It would be shredded. They had a shredding machine there, as I remember, and put in trash bags and thrown in the back dumpster out behind the building. And so, knowing what the complaint had been, pursuant to what Andrew had told me, I asked them, well, if you wouldn't mind, at the end of the week, which was several days hence, would you mind if I went and looked in your dumpster and check the contents of some of those bags? And they agreed to do that, not a problem. So we conducted our examination, went through the various points that you see delineated here in this report. And at the end of the week, before we left, I remember climbing up on the side of this dumpster, looking down, there were a number of black 55-gallon bags there tied. Couldn't see what was in them. They were intact. So I just randomly picked two and brought them back to the office, showed them to Andrea. We opened them up. They were full of unshredded documents from many consumers, from many states. These were what I clearly would consider sensitive documents, credit reports, credit applications, investment reports, items that had Social Security numbers on there, so on and so forth. So Andrew asked me to just take them all out, do an inventory, put them in a spreadsheet, write the report of exam, give it to her, which I did. And the results are here. This report actually is incomplete. There was a spreadsheet that accompanied this, and also all of the actual documents that were part of the original exam file are not here.
I'm going to ask you to suspend for a minute. Is this report in the public domain?
As far as I understand, yes. I thought that when I was looking for some documents and I went through them, I thought I came across those, but I can only be certain after I check on lunch what exactly we have on the record.
Okay, I'm going to ask you to check that for me.
We'll do so.
Thank you. You may continue.
When you said public domain, do you mean other than the hearing process?
Other than the hearing process.
I think it's on the banking website.
That's exactly what I was in my mind when I asked that question, and I guess what I'm asking you today is confirm that that is on the banking website.
Okay.
I think I have seen this. I think this is one of the ones I have read in the past in preparation for the start of these hearings. But just confirm for me that this is on that website, would you?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Mr. Gillies.
How many examiners did that exam in October of 2004? Examination?
Two. Myself and another individual.
Were they an experienced examiner?
No, she was pretty new. I seem to remember her name was Jill. I couldn't tell you her. I can't recall her full name. But I remember her. She was called Jill.
And how long did the examination take place?
Well, according to the report here, it lasted many months. But we were not on site from October 11, 2004 through April 21, 05. We were clearly not there on site during that period of time. I imagine there were other questions that we and documents that we requested that needed to be submitted from the company to the department. I'm sure Andrea had additional items that she probably requested pursuant to that. And so that's why you see a relatively long period of time for the report. But actually, on site, we weren't there more than a week.
The complaint that led you to check for the papers blowing in the parking lot, did you ever see that complaint?
I did not. In writing, I did not. I heard about it orally.
Was there a way in which complaints were usually handled around that time period?
I think initially all complaints were submitted to Andrea Boudreau.
Okay. Was that process changed as to how complaints were handled? Was it changed prior to that?
Going back a number of years, complaints would come in and my supervisor in the division would see that. And then I would be brought in, if necessary, to follow up with that. As a rule, complaints never went to me directly. No, they were in the hands of an attorney like that or a supervisor.
But prior to that time, they would?
I wasn't the one opening the mail. I wasn't making a decision, what was a complaint, what wasn't a complaint. That was all handled by my supervisors. But once a complaint was in-house, then typically I would be an individual who may be tasked with following up, with finding up the details and the veracity of that complaint.
Did you look at the prior examinations of that entity before you did the 04 exam?
If I did, Mr. Spill, I may have. I don't specifically recall if I did. I mean, it would stand to reason you would, because if there were violations found or observations made that would be of import to the next exam, you'd want to make a note of any recurring instance or activity. So I may have looked at something. And again, if we were under the new format, there would have been something 18 months previously, sometime in 03. Another examiner would have looked at that.
Now, did you check when you did your audit in 04, did you check for financial statements?
Yes, I did.
And what did you find with respect to the financials?
There was an audited set of financial statements available for the fiscal year ending December 31, 02. And every licensee is mandated to supply complete set of financial statements within 90 days following the end of their fiscal year end. And this company had not been able to do that. That is, for the fiscal year end 12/31/03, they'd not been able to do that. They supplied an unaudited set of financial statements, and they, as I recall, they said they were having problems completing that audit because of a issue going on with the Securities Bureau. But ultimately, we did get an audited set of financial statements for 12/31/03 in like November of 04. So it was subsequent to, or it was during the examination period. That would have been one of the, probably one of the documents that we needed as a result of doing the on-site exam. And they supplied that, but I had no audited set of statements or any indication that the statements for 04 were being prepared.
What was the net capital requirement at that time for that entity?
Well, under the RSA, I believe it would have been $100,000 for a first mortgage banker and broker.
Did they meet that?
If they, I don't have the details, and I don't remember that specifically, Mr. Spill. I don't recall. Again, that would be in the examination file. If they had to post a bond for $100,000, that would have been in the examination file.
Okay.
Or in the lights, there was a section of the division that handled all new and renew license applications. And they kept all those records in house.
So now, oh, okay, I'm sorry. Now, if you found a lack of compliance, would you describe that as a violation of some type of law?
No, it wasn't up to me to make that determination. I would cite observations, find and try to come up with some findings of fact. Let the attorney, my superiors, make the decision whether it was a quote violation or not.
And with respect to that October 04 exam, how many observations did you come up with?
On the first mortgage banker broker piece of it, looks like I came up with 14.
Was that a high number in your estimation at that time?
I'd say it was a pretty high number, yeah.
Would you say earlier you talked about the tiers for examination, and one of the tiers was problem entities. Would you say financial resources was identified as a problem entity?
I would.
With respect to one of your observations that identifies a failure to alert the banking department of an action by the Securities Bureau, was that something that you reported?
That's something I cited in my observation section. And the department did not have any written notification of that.
Was there also a lack of notification of a lawsuit that was pending?
I believe so. I think that's in there as well, yes.
Okay. Was the Securities Bureau action the action for unlicensed, unregistered activity?
That I don't know. I was unable to contact. I did not contact the Securities Bureau in this regard.
Okay. Why did you do that?
If I asked to do that, I either was told no, or if it was going to be done, it would likely have been handled by the attorney, Ms. Boudreau, who was also, you know, working with me on this particular matter.
Okay, are you aware of that being done?
I'm not.
What was the end result of this examination, if you can recall?
Obviously, it had been completed in 05. I remember Ms. Boudreau telling me that her piece of it was completed, too. And again, orally, that the recommendation was that this company would be brought in for a show cause hearing, for some kind of administrative hearing for adjudication.
So and this was referred for, you know, some type of enforcement action?
As I understood it.
I believe you said you went into a tour of duty with the military to Iraq?
In 06, yeah.
When was your last contact with the financial resources matter?
would have been the year prior to that, I remember asking. I had, 05 was a tough year. I lost my wife. First of all, I broke my leg in January of that year. I lost my wife to cancer in February of that year. I became very, very ill subsequently and was in the hospital for virtually the entire month of June that year. And recovered my strength and went back to work. And I remember asking Andrea on at least two occasions, you know, what's going on with that last job at FRM? And I was told it's pending.
Did the way in which the license renewal process change during the tenure at banking?
Yes, it did. Under Mr. Roberge and initially under Mr. Hildreth, it was a matter of taking a look at a lot of license application, new applications and renewals. There was one examiner in particular who was tasked with heading this effort up, Kerry Nolan. I thought he did a pretty outstanding job. He was very thorough, very detail-oriented. Ultimately, under Mr. Hildreth, a whole new staff was set up to handle license applications, and that was headed up by an individual who, as I recall, reported directly to Ms. Jerda. And so they were we as examiners were no longer involved with that, certainly directly, even indirectly, as I remember, because we were on the road doing these examinations now. We didn't have time for that, and this new staff that had been brought in, quite a number of individuals, at least three or four new individuals brought in to handle that. And as to the particulars of that, I couldn't address that. I don't know.
I have no further questions. Thank you.
Attorney Forsley, do you have any?
No, sir.
Okay. I have a few. Ms. Gillis, first, let me thank you for making yourself available to come here today, and I also want to thank you for your military service to this country. It's greatly appreciated.
Thank you for saying so.
As I've listened to you this morning, I have some general questions for you. I'm looking for your opinions on these. And I've sensed this transition that occurred with the appointment of Commissioner Hildreth. Is it your opinion that the banking department was adequately staffed when the arithmetic increase in examinations occurred?
Well, I would say on a numerical.
That's what I'm asking, is numerical.
I think there were enough examiners numerically to do, I guess in my opinion, the job that was required.
Okay. I think you've anticipated my next question in the manner in which you answered the first. And my next question deals with the adequacy of the training. You've explained today in the hearing the training that you've gone through, the courses that you've taken, your background, your experience that you brought to this job,
yes, sir,
for examinations. And you've rendered an opinion that there was adequacy in the number of examiners when we have had this arithmetical increase in examinations under Commissioner Hildreth. Were those examiners who are arithmetically available for examination, in your opinion, adequately prepared for this increase in workload?
I don't believe so, sir.
Okay. You also described a time of some substantial turnover,
mm-hmm,
early on.
Mm-hmm.
What, in your opinion, was the cause of that turnover?
Well, there were other opportunities available for examiners. I know two of my colleagues, at least, three, actually, no, four even. Dan, Janice. There were four colleagues who went to work for the FDIC. A number of others went back into the private sector. And this opened up, you know, opportunities within the department for advancement.
If somebody, in your opinion, from your observations of being in the department, was that for monetary purposes?
I think it was both professionally as well as monetary. I guess that there was a comment or a refrain periodically made that I didn't entirely agree with, but it was said at times that the banking department was riding the coattails of the feds when it came to doing examinations. This is a reference to the bank side, of course. Unlike the bank side, too, Mr. Chandler, Consumer Credit Division did not have, quote, a big brother like the banking side did. They have, you know, the NCUA, FDIC, you know, the OCC. There's a host of federal entities that are tasked with doing and conducting examinations of our nation's banks and credit unions and trust companies, as there have been for years. We didn't have, outside of the FTC, any kind of federal entity that was there to really conduct regularly scheduled examinations of the entities that we were tasked with overseeing. And we were overseeing entities that were quite large, multi-billion dollar companies. You know, there were a number of them. If you look at the top 10 mortgage companies at the time that had licenses with the New Hampshire State Banking Department, you could see where these were significant entities that I think would have been a challenge for well-trained accountants and auditors to really understand the inner workings of. And I think if they had understood the inner workings of, then they would have been concerned. I had concerns. I mean, I saw the subprime portfolio growing of a number of these large entities, and at least in my training, it took, all things being equal, took 10 good loans to make up for one bad loan. So if you have a subprime portfolio that's going upwards of 5, 6, 7%, you know, the economy moves in cycles. At some point in time, it's going to go south, and some of those loans are going to come home to roost. And as it turned out, virtually all of them did. And these companies went bankrupt or were under such financial stress that they had to be purchased by other larger entities or bailed out, as they call it, under the TARP program.
I believe you testified that directives were issued to alter the examination scope, and that's when you went from 60 or 70 in a year to hundreds.
Yes.
Who would have issued those directives?
It had to be senior management, Mr. Hildreth or Ms. Jurda or both or Mr. Fleury.
Did you participate in any of those discussions prior to those directives being issued?
I did not.
Okay.
I was tasked with compiling, formalizing a program to examine these entities. I tried to base it on my experience and the model that I was familiar with from the bank side. So we were going to try to take a look at, in banks, typically there's an alpha structure, which is rated on a scale of 1 to 5 as to the quality of that institution. That's called a CAMELS rating. CAMELS, you know, capital adequacy, asset.
I'm familiar with that.
Okay. So I was going to do something or propose something similar on the consumer credit side, not nearly as involved because we didn't have all the statutes and, you know, the federal statutes in particular to really flesh that out like I would have hoped, but it was a start. And I thought it would have been a good means to go forward to apply towards certainly the larger.
Did you ever make such a proposal?
I did, yeah.
And to whom did you make it?
I worked with Kim Griffin, who was my supervisor at the time, and we put that, and Robert Duclos, also a colleague of mine, another senior examiner, sorry to say, passed away He passed away early 09. We would have submitted that to Mary Cherda through her to deputy and commissioner.
What happened to that proposal?
I believe it was read, and it was. I remember Mr. Fleury talked to me about that. He talked to us, Mr. Griffin and I, about that, and Bob Duclos too. And they decided it wasn't feasible because they were afraid that the new examiners wouldn't be able to understand how this is all to be done and handled because they didn't have the background, because they didn't go to those schools that I mentioned to you earlier about. And I think it just didn't meet the mandate, or what they were looking at, the mandate to be examining large numbers of entities. You couldn't apply that schematic to hundreds of entities and have with a staff available and do it we were on a cycle where you had to take a look at all these entities every 18 months. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was a very, very short cycle where you were tasked with taking a look at.
I'm going to ask you a question. And the question I'm going to ask you is going to be prefaced by the words, is it fair to say? And I want you to think about my question and think about those words. Is it fair to say that, in your opinion, that after the change in the methodology of examination relative to the numbers, that banking was not spending enough time on exams with inadequately prepared examiners? Is that fair?
To a degree, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
I think the less complicated entities could be adequately examined given the staff, the background, the training, the circumstances under which the department was operating at the time. I think the larger entities and the more problematic entities, such as this, I don't believe those folks were, number one, inclined to want to go into that, because it's rather tortuous dealing with some of these folks out there. And you have to have some professional curiosity and some real, just interest. In
you've absolutely anticipated my follow-up question, because my follow-up question to the "is it fair to say" deal specifically was with FRM. Mm. Was there sufficient intellectual, professional curiosity within banking, in your opinion, relative to the subsequent to the 2004 examination of FRM?
Based on the results of my examination here, conducted with my colleague, as it was provided to our attorney, Ms. Boudreau, combined with her legal preparation, I understood this was going to be submitted to our superiors and an administrative hearing was going to be held.
And that hearing never occurred, did it?
Not to my knowledge.
Is it fair to say that you viewed FRM as a problem entity?
I did. I'm not going to tell you that I foresaw what ultimately is a Ponzi scheme.
So we're talking 2005 here, and in 2005, it's my understanding that you prepared an examination. There were 14 findings in that examination. You perceived it to be a problem entity, and there was no hearing process that resulted from this examination of yours.
Not to my knowledge, correct.
I'm going to direct your attention in that exam to finding number 13. In finding number 13, if I'm paraphrasing correctly, Financial Resources and Associates of the Lakes Region, Inc. informed you that they had received no complaints. Is that correct?
Correct. And as you can see there, apparently three complaints had been filed with the New Hampshire Banking Department, naming FRNA as the subject of a complaint. And these complaints were from the following individuals. Those names have been redacted here. However, there was some record there, some complaint. As to the nature of those, Mr. Chandler, I don't recall. But
nonetheless, they were characterized as complaints.
Yes. These would have been written complaints. A complaint's not an oral matter. It's a written document. We had, the department had a standard form to be completed, to be submitted to the department, to be recorded as a legitimate complaint.
I think you've explained well the circumstances of your life and personal circumstances, the timing of your examination in 2004, what has occurred subsequent to then. Were you surprised at your response when you inquired with the status of what we now call FRM and were told it was pending?
I was.
Why did that surprise you?
Well, as my old supervisor used to say, justice delayed is justice denied. And I thought this was big enough of a matter to warrant, you know, having an adjudicative hearing and fleshing out what exactly the circumstances were surrounding the activities of this entity. You know, not only addressing the matters that are detailed here in the report, but anything else that would have come up, such as the investigation being conducted, I guess, by the Securities Bureau at that time. I mean, my expectation up during my initial period of work at the department would have been cooperation with other entities, AG, securities, whomever, to find out what their records said. What had they heard about this company? Because typically, again, you know, where there's smoke, there's fire. And I found that out in a number of occasions dealing with some of these other entities that we had had hearings about or had had litigation on, and we'd successfully eliminated their tortious activities on the public, as well as on other legal, you know. We had an entity that was taking advantage of our lenders, our banks, you know, selling motor vehicles out of trust. I digress here, but
okay.
There was a record of successful cooperation with other agencies in an effort to try to get to the bottom of what was really happening at some of these entities that were licensed with us.
Okay. Did you participate in any way as a resource or as a participant in a 2006 examination of FRM?
No, I left the department.
I'm aware of that, but I didn't know, but possibly they had contacted you about something historical.
No, sir, I was in Iraq. I had communication.
Fair enough. I have nothing further.
Nothing further.
And once again, Mr. Gillies, I want to thank you very much for taking the time to make yourself available to come here. As I have stated, I think throughout this entire process, every witness opens another door for me. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gillies.
Thank you. You certainly are. You certainly are. Thank you, sir. Do we have somebody else this morning? Michelle?
You make the luncheon.
Oh. Are we off? We're off the record. We are back on the record. This is Presiding Officer Charles Chandler. Our next witness is a Mr. Richard Rolack, spelled R-O-L-L-O-C-K. Mr. Rolack, I noticed you were attended this morning. You understand that this is a public hearing. This matter is being recorded, and any testimony will be given under oath. Do you understand that? Would you raise your right hand, please? You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes.
Would you please state your name for the record and confirm the spelling of your last name for me, if you would, please?
Richard A. Rollick, R-O-L-L-O-C-K.
Thank you.
Attorney Wingate.
Thank you, Mr. Chandler. Attorney Earl Wingate. Mr. Rollick, you and I spoke back on December 7th, and I'm going to ask you many of the same questions I asked you then, and I thank you for appearing before us today. Would you please give us a brief background in terms of your education and work experience?
Well, I have a degree in business management from the state many years ago. I've worked for a number of years for Radio Shack and Cumberland Farms, and about the last, it's hard to say, 10 to 15 years, I've been with Financial Resources.
And you know Mr. Farah, Mr. Scott Farah?
Yes.
How did you meet him?
Actually, I was working in Cumberland Farms, and I think the only time, one and only time that he ever came in there that I remember, he came in, and for some reason we got speaking. And it turns out that he was looking for a real estate attorney. He had been recently started a mortgage company. And my now ex-wife had just graduated from Frank's, and she was a real estate attorney. She had a mortgage company before that. And
so you put the two of them together in terms of document preparation and legal work and that sort of thing?
This is the only time I ever met Scott. And I never saw him again until she had already spoken to him. After about 3 or 4 days, I said, have you called him? No. Call him. And she did. And they got together and it worked. We worked basically since then.
Let me interrupt you just briefly. Mr. Chandler informed you Mr. Rollick has certain medical issues that may require his absence on a rapid basis.
That's fine. That's fine. Okay. Appreciate that.
Thank you.
If you feel the need, do whatever you have to do.
Thank you.
The relationship between Mr. Farah and your ex-wife and yourself, did that culminate in you doing some legal work for Mr. Farah?
Yes.
And what work was that?
Do you want a little background on that, or do you want specifically?
Well, a little background.
I programmed with an old Cornerstone database, and when my wife first started working with him, I wrote the program that generated the paperwork. This was back in the early 90s. We would get a sheet of paper from the mortgage company with an approval and a list of the documents that were needed, and I would produce those documents from the data they sent me. They sent no paperwork, I mean, other than the summary. Marsha had lupus, and it has gotten so bad that she is three-quarters disabled. So she had to quit being his attorney. At that time, I started working directly for him. This was probably 2000, something like that. And nothing much changed as far as the work that I did.
Now, you spoke of mortgage companies. Did you, you being you and Mr. Farah, do business with mortgage companies?
Yes.
What companies?
Well, it's hard to tell. Most of them are Countrywide, New Horizons, Citibank, Citicorp. I can't think of.
In this time frame, is it fair to say that what you were doing was Mr. Farah was matching up borrowers with these commercial lenders?
The company was doing that. Scott didn't actually do very many loans. We had originators and processors and stuff that did that. I did a lot of the advertising and stuff, but basically by this time, probably the early 90s, mid 90s, the companies were starting to generate their own paperwork. So in other words, once there was an approval, it came to the company by UPS or however it came, with a complete set of documents and a backup copy. Financial Resources was totally residential. There was no commercial that was handled through it. From what I understand, there were a few things occasionally that Scott did commercially with commercial people, but there was no requirement within the state of New Hampshire that that be regulated by the state. To the best of my knowledge, it still isn't, but that I've heard rumors that they're starting to make it that no matter who you are, if you're lending money, you are regulated, but that's just a rumor.
Well, the legislature is in session, so guard your wallet. At this time frame, how big an operation was FR, middle 90s, 1995 or so, how big an operation was FRA or FRM? How many states did it cover, that sort of thing?
That's fairly hard to say, because I can give you an example. The license that we had in Idaho, we were going to hire somebody who would be a broker in Idaho. So I got the license. That turned out to be a major part of my job. And that person was not hired. So until early 2009, we never closed a loan in Idaho. We had the license for like 8 years. Whereas in Oklahoma, we had two offices. And it was a very active one. They had their own processes and stuff like that. And but the loans eventually ended up in our, you know, we stored them after they were closed and everything, and they were approved. So it ranged from no loans in 10 or 12 states to dozen loans in three or four states, maybe 25 to 50 loans in a couple of states. This is in the course of a year.
Now you were licensed in approximately how many states?
When we closed, we were licensed in 13 states. There have been a number of states, Washington State, I can't think offhand, where we no longer kept the license. Rhode Island.
Now, I want to be clear, we're dealing with residential mortgages where FRA or FRM was being the broker of the mortgage with a commercial lender.
Absolutely. To the day, and my knowledge, to the day that the operation closed, I don't know of any commercial loans that Financial Resources did. Now, don't get me wrong, Scott Farah was the president of Financial Resources. But I don't know what all this business is about. Financial Resources didn't do any of this. Financial Resources was your mortgage broker right to the end, residential. Scott Farah may have used money from another company in Financial Resources, but Financial Resources didn't have anything to do with it. As a matter of fact, the last day that we were in business, Scott was taking a test on the internet for a mortgage originator's license.
A mortgage originator's license?
Yeah. The new, even though he'd been a banker since April of 1989, the new federal law said that you must be an originator. No matter how high in the company you are, if you handle people's documents, you had to be an originator. And he was in the process of getting that.
And this was in November of 2009?
As a matter of fact, my guess is November 5th, 6th. He was on 3 days. Now, we did hear the results of the past.
Now, have you heard that another company, CLMN, or other companies associated with FRM were doing commercial lending?
Of course.
And can you tell us about that?
I don't know how it happened. I don't know what brought it up, but they incorporated it in Nevada. And Don Dodge was the president of that. Scott really was the controlling entity in that. I know about it because I invested in the company. I was on my either, I can't remember, I think it's my, I was on my second loan with CLM, my IRA, I was through Pensco, and Pensco handled the mortgage and the note, and Bayport. So I think I have a kind of a special distinction. I was the only employee to invest in the company. I'm the only employee who lost their job in their house because of it. And I have nothing now. I've lost everything. Not only the money that I invested, but the house that I live in, and I hope there's nobody else that had that same problem. If you invest in this company and didn't lose your house, consider yourself lucky.
Well, you, I appreciate that. I think there were others in your circumstance as far as the house is concerned, but were you present during banking audits?
Oh, yes.
Adam, do you recall how many banking audits you were present for?
I don't recall the audit that he spoke of, but I recorded the one with Kim, certainly the next couple of audits with Kim.
That'd be Timothy Griffin.
Mm-hmm. And then along about 2007, we started getting these kids that we had kind of a struggle with them because they weren't banking examiners, they were well-educated college graduates. And I suppose they did a good enough job. But an audit rarely looked at the company. An audit, the job of an audit is to make sure that the banking commission is protecting the client. An audit, oh God, I've seen this so many times. They'll be down in a conference room like this, and there'll be, we have our file cabinets, thousands, hundreds and hundreds of closed loans, all residential. And the auditor would go down a list, we would print from our electronic record, print a list of all the closed loans we'd done in the last year. And he would go through that list and tick off maybe one out of every seven that either he would then go into the files and get and put on the desk, or we would go and get it, put those for him. And that's what an audit is. An audit isn't, well, there are branches of it that are, we don't want fraud going on. But an audit is to protect the clients, make sure that they're getting their paperwork in 3 days if it was required by law, or 5 days if it was required by law, or a duplicate copy of it, or... One of my specific jobs was to work with a list of things that they found wrong with specific loans. And in some cases, we returned money to clients just because we didn't do something right. The thing might have got mailed in 6 days instead of five. Just, I don't know exactly. But I can remember at least three or four audits where I've gone down the list and I've sat with the vice president of the company and we've checked off an item. Well, that one's okay. Now this one I was suggesting that one of our attorneys look at the answer. I don't know what it is. And then we'd go through until we had them all checked, and then we would turn it in. And if we had everything go the way it should, then we would have probably not heard from the banking commission again. Maybe we would have got some kind of a note, but the odds are that they've already got the thing. And if we've turned in a checklist of them all, bringing them up to snuff, they've done their job too. I mean, because granted that I'm looking at the audit from a different point of view from them. You know, I mean, I know what, you know, I don't know what they do for training and stuff, or I don't know what their orders are for. But they're there to protect the clients, that the client's not having money taken from them that shouldn't be taken.
Now, when you're talking about the audits, are you talking about the residential loans done through commercial entities?
Financial Resources was all residential loans. It is, I look in the paper and I see FRM. Well, it's only been FRM for 1 year. It was Financial Resources National before that. And it turned out that because we are a banker, we can't use the word national in our title because we're not a banker, we're a mortgage banker. So we didn't discover that until it was already changed.
And now, just to set a little stage here, you had worked for Scott Farrow for a number of years. What position did you ultimately occupy in his organization?
On paper, it was personal assistant to the president.
And where was your office?
On the opposite corner of the second floor. I also shared an office in the sense that Scott had two computers, one for his regular stuff and one that had just accounting software on it. The accounting software was on a computer that had no connection to the internet, and he wanted that to be in his office. So my desk and a good share of the work that I did was a desk that connected it, butted right up against his desk in the office, you know, and so.
Did you work on that computer that he had isolated from the internet with his accounting software? Did you work on that one yourself?
Yes. He didn't have enough understanding of the particular program to even print a check.
So did you run accounting software with him, for him?
Yes.
What did you do?
I was an input. I input checks and road checks and input deposits as they were returned to me. I didn't make the top deposits usually, but they came to me and I had to bring the paperwork up to the computer.
What, if anything, did you notice as far as payments or improper payments or cash out, checks out, that sort of thing?
I didn't notice anything. As far as this whole overall program is concerned, I got my check every month, along with a statement as to, you know, what I still had in there hadn't been dispersed. As far as my paycheck went, I got it every month, and the 401k and everything was all running properly. I wrote checks that went out every month. I'm not sure that there was anything that would have caught my eye.
Did you write the checks for interest payments, for example? Was that
No. Don't get me wrong. That was CLNM. That was a totally separate business. I got a check from them, and I got a statement from them. I don't know anything about the business other than the fact that my first mortgage closed, and it rolled over, and when the money came in, I invested it in another one. And they never missed a payment, or there was no hint that they were going to miss a payment.
Who handled the software, the payments, and that software?
Diane Smith.
Now,
and she was also an investor.
Were you aware that Mr. Farrow was moving money from account to account?
Yes.
And can you tell us how, what
well, the my understanding of it was is that money that was in some kind of a limbo in between being put to work and having been received went into some kind of rollover account that the bank kept because it was, who knows, 0.5% more interest or something. And it was just shifted back and forth as it was needed. I mean, I didn't, you know, because I never saw any of those accounts. And all I ever got was the deposit receipts from the bank. So I have no idea, you know, who wrote the checks to the company.
Are you aware of use by Mr. Farrow of money to shore up later accounts? Earlier accounts, rather, with money received for later transactions?
I was certainly not aware of it at the time. It's something that you can't help but know it now. It's in every paper in the Eastern United States. I don't even get a paper. At the time, remember I told you that about a week before this, I was sitting there. For some reason, I was just thinking about money. I had just purchased my house. My home burned in 2005. I lost everything then, and it took me a couple of 3 years to replace the house. And I replaced it with one of these loans. I paid $1,600 interest for 1 month. But it got me the house, paid it off in 1 month. For some reason, I thought, you know, at least I know one millionaire in this country. And on paper, he was. All I ever saw was the paper, though. I didn't see anything else. Financial Resources was a retail mortgage operation from day one to the end. It is not involved with this. Scott was involved with this.
Were you present when Scott spoke with lenders about certain projects? Were you present for those conversations?
Sure. Yeah, his desk was the next desk to mine.
Okay.
And he painted a glowing picture about many of them. And they were right. They were accurate. These people had a chance to look at sometimes hundreds of pages of documentation on a project. You know, and if there's any question, you can do anything that you wanted to do to check that project out. As a matter of fact, you could have checked us out. I don't know how many people did. But looking back on it, it might have been the best thing to check out.
What sort of things do you recall Mr. Farah telling the lenders?
Well, that's a hard one. I know that I've heard him mention a number of times that as far as the servicing company was concerned, he's known Don Dodge since Scott was a boy or a young man, 20, 25 years. I don't know. I think he's mentioned a couple of times that in my hearing that the person that he was touting for a loan, he had known for a number of years. We checked him out. We had a huge amount of paperwork on him, you know, but you're welcome to do more. That was the main thing. We'll give you anything you want to know about the company, and you're welcome to do whatever else due diligence you want to do. I don't recall any other specific.
Were you familiar with some of the spending Mr. Farah did that was not related to the business, such as charitable donations?
Yes.
What sort of charitable donations were you familiar with?
He sent money every month, every week, to the church in Santa Ana.
About how much was that, do you recall?
About $2,000 a week.
Now, was this money that you had printed off, checks that you printed off to send out?
Yes.
Okay. And
now, the computer was set up so that these regular checks would automatically print out on Wednesday or Thursday, or the 25th of the month, or whatever the date was. But he also supported a group here in Manchester for recovering alcoholics. He had a small donation monthly to a man down in South Carolina, Augie David.
The evangelist?
Yes. And he in Manchester, it's a group of young men that go around with a choir and say, it just doesn't come to my head.
Teen Challenge?
Yeah, Teen Challenge. He sent them about $500 every month. He sent $250 to Augie every month. There's a man over in Ghana, Africa, a minister, his name is Miles Aiken. He got $1,000 a month. That went into an account in Washington that his sister was She's an attorney in Washington, D.C. But he comes over in his tribal costume several times a year.
Mr. Wingate,
yes,
a little clarification. Whose sister?
Sorry, Papa Miles, Miles Aiken's sister,
okay,
was the recipient of it. So it wasn't sent out of the country. It went to a Washington, D.C. bank.
Yeah.
I can't put my finger on anything else, but it's...
So in other words, the computer was programmed to generate checks on a regular basis to a certain number of charities?
Charities and other regular payments, credit card payments or, you know, whatever.
Okay. Do you know, without knowing the names, do you know how many charities he gave you?
Six or seven. But it was a noticeable amount of money every month, you know.
Do you know roughly how much it was every month?
Well, it was $1,500, $250, $2,000. That's all I can remember. There were a couple of more, but I don't know. They all had all related to religion in some way.
Now, you're familiar. You were working with Mr. Farah, but also was in the same building as Mr. Dodge, correct?
A different floor.
Different floor. Who was in charge of things?
That's an easy one. I've seen Dodge have to write a letter to one of his clients, and he'd have to bring it down for Scott to approve. Scott ran it, absolutely. Absolutely. Everything.
Were you present for audits of the business?
I sat in on some of the introductory parts in knowing what their requests were for paperwork, and that I would be available to answer any questions as it was going along. What's that?
I'm sorry. Who was the auditor?
Kim.
I'm talking about the bank audits. I'm talking about a private audit.
Oh, the private auditor was Tom Connor.
Bill Connor?
Bill Connor down in Manchester. And yes, I didn't work with him on the audit, but whenever he needed anything, I would find it for him.
Do you know what Mr. Connor looked at in making his audits?
He looked at everything. Oh, whenever anything happened in the company, the receipt went into a drawer. And that drawer was just the lifeblood of the company. It had everything. Credit card payments, and at the end of the year, I sorted that drawer and presented it to Bill, all separated by credit cards and whatever else there was, telephone bills.
Mr. Roth, what's your view of what happened here?
He didn't see it coming.
He being Farah?
Yeah.
He didn't see it coming.
He didn't. He thought, I am sure, this is my opinion, but I feel that he didn't see that if he borrowed a little money now, he'd repay it back in over the years. Anytime that he needed something, if anybody was there that could loan him money, and he always paid it back. It got out of hand, and he just, I don't know any other way, he just drove himself into it.
Robbing Peter to pay Paul?
I don't think it was that way. It certainly wasn't intended that way. It was intended to keep the business going and the 60 or 70 employees around the country in operation. You know, it's I'm on Social Security now. I'm 70 years old. I've been through a cancer scare this year. I lost my house, got I got the paperwork yesterday. I lost my job. And when I went to unemployment, the person that I talked to there suggested that I put down as a job that I might be interested in as a banker teller. After a while, I stopped going because they laughed at me so much. I was working for a banker that was being investigated by the FBI, and I was using that as a reference. We didn't know.
Thank you. I have no other questions. Mr. Chandler?
Attorney Forster, do you have any?
I just have a couple. Mr. Rolick, Eric Forster, State of New Hampshire. You said that you were in charge of recording the money coming in. You weren't actually going to the bank and depositing or cashing checks, but you were taking the receipt and inputting it into a computer.
Yes, that's true.
Did you also see incoming wire transfers?
They were available for me, but it wasn't part of my job. When I did wires, I did outgoing wires, and those I had to enter into the wire account. And I never bothered to look at the money because I knew that if I was looking at something that was like $230,000 coming in, it probably was something that from CL&M.
So you were aware that a lot of money was being wired?
Oh, sure.
After 2005 from
CL&M? Oh, sure, of course.
Did you ever wonder what the source or reason for why all the monies were being wired from CL&M?
No.
Most
of the money, in my experience, most of the money came, or a lot of it came to Financial Resources. Then Financial Resources transferred it to CL&M because it was Financial Resources president who was making the contact and was suggesting that it might be a good investment to look at some of the commercial, the stuff that was done through CL&M. So a lot of it came to Financial Resources, but that was just a pass-through.
Right, a lot of the money then would be passed through to CL&M.
That's correct. That's correct.
But what I'm talking about is wires coming from CL&M to FRM, which would be opposite.
I didn't know that they did.
So you don't recall seeing any wires coming to FRM?
I can't imagine that would be necessary, would it? I mean, they're in the same building, the same bank. Why do they need a wire money? Just take the bag downstairs and hand it? No.
I understand they weren't necessarily dealing in cash, so they would have to.
I understand. But the banks, the transfers don't have to be by wire when they're in the same bank. But I don't know. They could have been a lot.
Okay. My only other question was, you referenced your house burning in 2005. It's not the first time I've heard about that. Going back to Center Harbor Christian Church, were you a member of that church?
I am not a member of the church. I've been going to the church regularly since about 15 years. I also attend the Lutheran Church in Laconia at 8 o'clock every Sunday. And
do you still attend both these churches?
Yes, I do. I've missed, in the last 18 years, I've missed 4 8 o'clock services. Gee, that sounds stupid if I'm supposed to say that.
I have no further questions.
I have a few, Mr. Rowland.
Sure.
Partway through your testimony this morning, you talked about, you characterized yourself as an investor with FRM, and you mentioned that as a result you have lost your house. Let me ask you, did you ever become or have any interest in CL&M Inc.? Did you have
you must have missed the point a little bit.
No.
I invested in CL&M.
Okay. How did you invest in CL&M?
I have an IRA that is with Pensco Trust Company. And Pensco Trust Company holds the mortgage and the note. And they forwarded the money to CL&M.
This is exactly what I'm trying to find out. I don't misunderstand, believe me.
Okay, that's what I did.
Okay.
So I have $27,000, which is the only IRA that I have, or the only retirement that I have now, invested in there. The way I lost the house was because of my job, not the IRA. I was paying approximately four take-home pays. for my mortgage because it was the wrong time of the year, and I was making up some of the back taxes. So for the first few months, it was like $1,900 a month house payments.
Do you ever have an interest as an owner of CL&M?
No.
You weren't a participant in CL&M?
No.
Did you sit on the board of directors of the corporation
No.
in any way? Did you
No.
participate in making management decision processes in
No.
CL&M?
No.
Did you have an ownership interest in FRM or any of its predecessors?
No.
Did you ever sit on the board of directors of FRM?
No.
Did you ever participate in any management decisions of FRM?
No.
Okay. What you had was then a mortgage. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And when you use the word invest, you are telling me that that word means to you this mortgage relationship.
Right.
Okay. That's exactly.
I invested in the mortgage.
That's exactly what I'm getting at. I understand what you're saying to me.
Yes.
You and I may have different words for things, but I fully understand what you're saying. When you responded to Attorney Force here, about your religious relationships and going to the church in Santa Harbor, did you ever hear Scott Farah's father
Yes.
preach or in any way suggest in the church that people should invest with his son?
No. Can I just make a little statement here?
Absolutely.
Financial Resources and Assistance of the Lakes Region, Inc. was incorporated on April 18th, 1989. Okay? The audit for 2009 stated that it was valued at about $1.5 million. Okay? If you had a son that had been in business 20 years, and it was 20 years, April 18, who had for 20 years run a successful business, wouldn't you talk about it? I think that any talking that he did was as a proud father. I can't, he didn't have anything to do with the business, really didn't even know, I don't know, what? But he sure was proud of his son.
But you heard it. Is it fair to say then that you heard him speak in the church
No.
setting of the pride of
No.
his son?
No. Oh, yes.
Of the
Yes.
pride of his
Yes.
son.
Yes. But as far as encourage anybody to invest in it, I never heard that at all.
Okay. But your recollection was, and I think your testimony is incorrect. Please correct me if I'm wrong. That you were aware of $2,000 a week going from...
Oh, I wrote the check.
$2,000 a
yeah,
week.
Yeah, physically, sure.
Are you aware of any lump sums going from FRM to the church? Large lump sum?
No, there weren't. There weren't any.
There weren't any that you were aware of. Is that correct?
How are you going to write a check for a large sum without having it show up? Anyway, okay. No.
Okay, fair enough. I have nothing further.
Mr. Chandler, I've been asked to ask another series of questions.
Follow up if you wish.
Thank you very much. On that last point concerning Robert Farah, did you ever see Robert Farah signing any documents concerning FRM or FRA or CL&M or anything like that at all? Is Robert Farah the preacher to the pastor?
I don't know.
Okay.
I don't know.
You say you don't know. I mean,
I've never sat in any meeting or anything where he signed anything. I don't know whether there was ever a time when a piece of paper was there and he just said to his dad, would you sign this? I mean, that's not... But I've never been in any meetings where any paper's been presented for him to sign.
Yeah. Well, you had written checks to these charities, or these checks you'd come off the printer for these
Yes.
charities. Are you familiar with checks being written for businesses apart from the charities that were not related to FRM or FRA?
Oh, sure. All of the payments, of people doing work for financial resources were paid, you know, by financial resources. People that are going out to look at houses and appraisers and stuff like that.
Well, these would be for legitimate work done on behalf of the company?
Financial resources?
Right.
I don't know. I mean, see, a lot of times I would be told to write a check. Write a check to Joe Jones for $2,000. Let me put anything in the memo. No, don't bother.
I see. Okay, there was the check. You were.
I not only might not know who Joe Jones was, but I didn't know what it was for.
All right, that's fair. All right. Are you familiar with a business called JLN Enterprises?
Yes, I am.
What is it?
What was it?
It was a
small company that was set up to do loans outside of the mortgage field back when financial resources had a license for small loans. Then they did away with the license, both the small loans and were all rolled into the banker's license.
Yeah. So who were the principals in JLN?
Me.
You?
Yes.
Okay.
Never used it for anything.
Okay. I just want to clarify. It's the JLN Enterprises, was it a DBA? Was it a corporation?
It was a corporation.
It was a corporation. Okay.
Yes.
And was Mr. Farah part of that?
No.
It was yours?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was to use if financial resources had somebody such as, I'm not sure, needed to borrow $500 to make a payment on that car or something like that. It was something so that financial resources didn't do anything outside its license. I look at it now and I say, well, JLM maybe was doing something outside of his license, but we never did anything with it. But that's what it was intended for.
When did it start? When was it started?
2002, something like that.
And when did it close?
It became defunct. I would suspect about 2006.
Did the JLN?
Those are my three kids' initials, incidentally.
Ah, okay. I wondered. Cash a check? Receive a check from Ron or Howard Stone?
Could be. I'm not sure what. You know, any of those things with it. Ron's father was going into a nursing home, and he wanted to invest in something for his father. And so he had a power of attorney, and even though his father was there, I think there was a check for about 156, but I don't remember whether it passed through JLM or not. If it did, it was paid right out. Back out immediately.
Are you familiar with businesses known as insurance options?
That was a legitimate company. That was an insurance company owned by Scott Farah. It was operated by Alice Straw, who was the licensed representative, and it was eventually sold to an insurance company in Manchester. I can't think of who it was that it was sold to, but insurance options was a legitimate a PNC rather.
Are you familiar with a business known as Shelbrook Publishing?
No, I've heard the name, but
Shelbrook Publishing.
Yeah, I've heard the name, but I don't know anything about it.
SMM Realty Trust.
One of those things that was under a whole list of them that Scott had for, I don't know what it means. I've heard the name.
And finally, Earth Protection Systems?
I've heard that. I didn't think it had anything to do with us.
What what's your recollection, what's your knowledge of what's that?
Earth Protection System somehow ringed a bell with Gary Coyne, but.
All right, I have no other questions. Thank you, Mr. Roll.
Terry Fossey, do you have any follow up?
Just one quick follow up.
Sure.
With respect to JLN, did JLN ever have a bank account?
Yes.
So money. Why, in your opinion, would money pass through JLN?
Money didn't pass through. It sat there, like $200. Finally, we closed it out because it was costing us more to keep the account open than it was being used.
What was the purpose of money sitting there?
Just so that the account would be open if we ever, and it was, it might be $150, $200, $300, because any money that was put into it went right out. It was just a collection thing, and I.
Why would it pass through? Like Mr. Stone's money said, may have passed through.
I don't know why.
No further questions.
And like I say, it didn't stay in there, so it went, I don't know. I don't know just where it went. But that was before CLM also.
Before CLM money would go there, sit there.
But no, I'm saying the Ron Stone business was before CLM.
I understand that.
So that had that was just an individual.
No further questions.
Did you create that company at the behest of Scott Farah?
Yes.
So he asked you, set this up.
Yeah.
We're going to use it somehow.
Yeah. Well, like I said, we had a license for a small loan lender. We had a broker's license and we had a banker's license. Well, it turned out that sometimes somebody would come up there and say to Scott, I am in really tough shape. You know, is there any chance that you could let me have $200-$300 for a couple of weeks? And that's what it was intended for. And as I recall, it was never used for that. But that was basically it. Because
who had the right to write checks out of this bank account?
Me and... There was somebody else. I can't remember.
Could it have been Mr. Farah?
No, it wasn't Scott.
But let me ask you a
and there was no other family member.
Let me ask you a follow-up question that I simply failed to ask when you confirmed the testimony that a check of $2,000 a week went to the Santa Harbor Church.
Yes.
For how many weeks did that go on?
It's hard to tell exactly because he did $1,000 a week for a couple of years. I don't know, at least a year.
Could it be more?
Well, sure, it could be more.
Okay.
I don't know how much more. Okay. But before it became, if it was more than than a year, before it became 2,000, it was 1,000 for a couple of years.
Okay. I have nothing further. Gentlemen?
Nothing further from me, gentlemen. Thank you.
Nothing, sir.
Thank you. Okay. Mr. Rolick, thank you very much. We're going to go off the record for just a minute. We're going back on the record. If there's any conversations, I'm going to ask you to take them outside. We have Mr. Joseph Austin, who has been patiently waiting this morning. Ms. Austin, I noticed that you have been here this morning and you're aware of the process in this hearing. We are on the record. This is a recorded public hearing. Any testimony that you give will, in fact, be under oath. You're aware of that?
I am aware of that.
Would you raise your right hand, please? Do you solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give and the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help you God?
I do.
Okay. Mr. Austin, as you may have heard me state earlier, many witnesses have come forward with prepared statements and have read them into the record. Others also, without prepared statements, have desired to speak extemporaneously and give an opening statement into the record. Either are acceptable to me, but if you don't have either a prepared statement or don't wish to make an extemporaneous statement, we can simply proceed. Do you have a statement?
I have no prepared statement.
Okay. Mr. Spill, do we want to start?
Thank you. I have some questions for you, Mr. Austin. Thank you for coming today. Where do you reside, sir?
I reside at 16B Trap Road, Chichester, New Hampshire.
And what do you do for work?
I presently don't do anything for work. I've been in the construction field most of my life.
Can you describe that experience for us?
Well, I've built bridges for E.D. Sweat. I've worked for Pike Industries and Heath Construction, doing road work and running road jobs.
You actually run the equipment that builds the roads, or you just supervise?
Well, I've done both, actually. I worked my way up by running the equipment, and I ended up as project manager for some of the jobs that Pike Industries and Keith Construction ran.
So is your experience in the earth-moving type of construction?
It is.
Okay. How about building construction? Do you have any experience?
I have some. I'm limited with the building construction, but I do have some.
Okay, I'd like to call your attention to the White Birches Condominium Project. Are you involved in that project?
I'm the owner of that project.
Okay, when did you first become involved with that project?
Well, I've had a piece of property in Chichester for 40 years that came down through the family. And recently, with the zoning changes in the last 10 years that have gone on in Chichester, I was able to convert that into a 55 or over condominium project.
What's the location of it?
It's 365 Dover Road in Chichester, New Hampshire.
Okay. Do you live on or near where the subdivision is?
I do live on the subdivision. It's bordered by Trap Road. I used to own property on both places. Now I own the property that is on Dover Road.
So this piece of land has been in your family for 40 years?
More than that, actually.
When did you start the process of developing it?
Well, I started a home on it some 20 years ago, and I've worked on it off and on and lived there over the past 20 years.
And when did you determine that you wanted to subdivide the land?
Well, as I said before, when the zoning turned around in Chichester so that you could do a 55 or over development on the piece that I own, I decided to develop it.
About what year was that?
Well, the year I started to develop it was about 2004.
Did you own the land free and clear?
No, I had a mortgage at that time.
How much was the mortgage for?
It was for about $150.
And who held the mortgage?
Commercial credit out of Concord.
What steps did you take to develop the land? Could you kind of walk us through, you know, the planning portion? And this land was condominiumized, correct?
Well, it wasn't at that time. It was one raw piece of land, but it's in the commercial zone. So Chichester developed a plan where they wanted to increase the productivity of backland. So I own 14 and a half acres that abuts Route 4, but I had no roadway to the backland. So if I was able to put a roadway into the backland, I could utilize it, because they have a 1,000-foot setback for commercial property in Chichester. So thereby, if I were to go through the town and be okayed for a 55 or over community, I could put in a road and utilities and become eligible to do a 55 or over condominium project. So I initiated that development.
Did you apply to the Attorney General's office for condominium approval?
Before I reached that step, what I did was I enlisted the aid of a partner. And this partner was supposed to develop the road and do that portion, and in exchange receive so much of the development. We went on for about 3 years, and the road never got developed and the economy took a turn for the bad, so they were having problems considering continuing with it. So I asked them to pull out and give me the option of going with another entity, being Financial First. So for...
Do you mean Financial Resources?
Yes. I'm sorry, Financial Resources. So they agreed to take a second on monies that they had put in over that period of time and monies they had paid me to become a partner in this project. Once they did that, then we continued our paperwork and applied to the Attorney General's office for condo acceptance.
When was that?
It was, I believe, in 2005, I would say. 2005 or 2006, I'm not exactly sure.
Was the partner's name Gatchell?
It was, Paul Gatchell.
And how much was the mortgage, second mortgage, Mr. Gatchell?
That was 3.25.
So at this time, was the mortgage on the land totaling 325 or 325 plus 150?
It was 325 plus 150.
Okay. Did you seek additional financing?
I did. I sought to get additional financing to do the road and the underground utilities and some work on the house on the property from Financial First.
Okay. You mean Financial Resources?
Financial Resources.
Okay. The money to pay Mr. Gatchell for his participation, the $325,000, where did that come from?
That came from Mr. Gatchell's construction company that he owned. Over a period of time, he set forth money to me for his partnership. He paid me for his partnership in payments, I should say.
And how much money did you borrow from Financial Resources?
Well, originally it was supposed to have been $900,000. And
I should say through Financial Resources.
Yes. Well, actually, it is very problematic because I was told that I would be borrowing the money through Financial Resources when I first applied. And then at a later date, I was told that actually I wasn't getting the money through Financial Resources. I was going to be getting it directly from borrowers, but Financial Resources and CL&M would be handling the transaction, so they were to get fees for doing so.
You mean lenders, right?
Yes.
Okay. When it was all said and done, how much of a mortgage did you obtain through Financial Resources and CL&M?
It was about 1.2 when it was all said and done.
1.2 million?
Yes.
So the amount of mortgages on the property would be 1.2 plus the 325 plus the 150?
That's correct.
Was the 1.2 million a third mortgage or in first position?
Actually, it went into first position. Because Mr. Gatchell agreed to take a second through Financial First, but not through these other individuals.
Okay. How much of that money did you actually physically, of the $1.2 million, did you actually physically come into possession of?
Let's say approximately $330 to $350 in that range.
Did you actually handle that amount of money, or did somebody else handle it?
I was required to have a company do X amount of work. When that work was performed, they would send an individual, Tom Haley?
Hawley.
Tom Hawley. And he would do an inspection, make sure that the work was up to snuff and that it was acceptable, and then they would cut checks for that work for me to pay to the individuals that performed it.
Okay, what work did you have done?
I had a road put in, subgrade put in, and then the road all up to top. There never was a top put on it, but up to top was put in, and underground utilities were put in, and some carpentry was done on the second portion of the home to include drywall, electrical, flooring, plumbing, everything you would need in a home. And there was a pond also dug. This work was all done and paid for in increments when it was approved.
Were utilities also brought in?
They were.
Okay. Was all the infrastructure completed or partly completed?
Well, it's all completed up to top of the road. You have your subgrade for the road, you have your materials that goes in above that, and then you have what they call coarse pavement and top pavement. We did the road differently. We put in, usually the coarse pavement and top pavement are 2-inch binder and 1.5-inch binder for top. We actually put in 24 inches of base, compacted in 4 separate lifts, as they did for the Concord Hospital. Concord did for the Concord Hospital. We did it that way, and the top never got put on.
Okay, so is it fair to say that at this point you have a condominium project that has no buildings on it, but has a partly completed road?
Three-quarters of the road is complete, and the underground utilities are in, and the fire pond is in.
Was the $1.2 million to complete the project?
The $1.2 million was to, and once again, this is a land-only condominium project. And the $1.2 million was basically to do this work and then pay interest payments that they required over originally an 18-month time period that eventually grew to a 36-month time period.
Okay. Could you have been able to complete the project with the money you had borrowed?
No.
Okay, about how far would that get you into the project?
Well, the way it was explained to me by Mr. Farrow was we would do this in segments. We would put the road and the underground utilities in. Once we had done that, then he would seek lenders to build the homes. And as we did that, we would progress and do whatever else needed to be done along the way. It never reached that point. We never sold one home.
And this was a 17-unit condominium project?
It was actually 14 units, and then there was a large home that the town allowed to be 2 units. That was the only building on the property, where I lived myself in one of those units.
Do you know what the projected sale price would be for one of the condominium units?
Well, when we did this was back when the economy was good, and we had an estimator figure that we could sell in the 280 to 310 range. They lent 45 on each unit. So since this was a land-only condominium project, they felt they could lend half of what the assessed value of the lot, I shouldn't say lot, I should say unit, would be.
Were you at the time period where you were putting the road in, was anybody attempting to pre-sell the units?
No. Okay. No.
Did you register with the local registry of deeds the condominium approvals?
I did not. I did not because at that time the economy had turned and the Gatchells had informed me they could no longer do this. So at that point, when I went to Mr. Farrer and we did this loan, I explained to him that I did not have condominium. I had the approval through the Attorney General's office, but I did not have the condo docs. And he said to me, have you sold anything yet? And I said, no. And he said, then you don't need condo docs until you sell something. So we can do this in stages and get the condo docs. And don't worry about it, we have lawyers that take care of this stuff. So I didn't pursue it any further.
Were you aware that title insurance was placed on these individual units?
I had an idea that it was, but I was made particularly aware of it when this all went south and everything went bad. I took out paperwork that I'd received. I received a manila folder each month, and my wife and I looked through it, and we saw that each one of the lenders did have title insurance. However, the title insurance people said that they were not responsible for the title insurance because there were no condo docs.
No condo docs in existence or none filed with the registry?
None filed with the Attorney General's office. The condominium paperwork was filed with the registry, the Attorney General's office, but the condominium documents themselves were never filed. I just want to be clear on that.
Sure. I think what you mean is like the bylaws, right?
Yes, the bylaws. There were no bylaws filed. And so they said because no bylaws were filed, they were not responsible to cover the title insurance.
Are you aware of what happened to the remainder of the $1.2 million?
Well, a lot of it went to the interest, and some of it just disappeared.
Did you ever come into possession of it?
I never came into possession of any money that wasn't given to me through checks.
For the road?
For the road and the housework and work like that.
You know who a Mr. McNeil is?
I do, Tom McNeil. He is the one that I originally sought or talked with about this loan. And he was an employee of Scott Farrell's. After I received the loan and started doing the work, then Scott Farrell himself dealt with me. And we had several back and forths about how we were going to finish and what needed to be done and what steps he was going to take to see the project through.
What did Mr. McNeil say to you about the loan?
Well, at one point in time he asked me where I spent the money because it wasn't there. And I said, what are you asking me for? You guys give me the checks, you know. If the money isn't there, and I don't have the checks, it couldn't be me spending the money. The money's coming out of this place somewhere. And he shook his head and didn't inquire any more about it. But I inquired to Scott myself because I was irritated because I no longer had the money to work with. And he told me that there was some kind of a mistake. He didn't know exactly what it was, but we would redo things and get enough money to finish up and not to worry about it.
When did you have that conversation with Mr. McNeil? When he said, what'd you do with the rest of the money?
Well, I'd have to look back in my records, but it was probably 5 or 6 months at the very most between the time they closed.
Prior to the time they closed?
Prior to the time they closed.
What is the status of the project now?
Well, right now it's in bankruptcy court because the bankruptcy lawyers have tried to pool it with all of the other developments that were involved with Scott and Mr. Dodge and say that they commingled my funds with other properties So I have to go to bankruptcy court and show my records that show that I can prove where monies went from people that lent me money.
Were you involved in the various closings that where people, the lenders had given you the money?
Never met the people.
Did you sign the documents?
I actually, looking back on it, it was rather foolish, but they had me sign all the documents in one day prior to even having the mortgage.
Did you have to give information, creditor history, to get the loan?
No, I used my security. I wouldn't have been able to, and that was one of the reasons I used them, because I did not have good credit. So I used the security of my property to receive the loan. They sent an estimator to look at the property and the building and determine there was adequate security there to give the loan.
Did you provide any credit history to Scott Fair, tax returns, or anything of that nature?
I don't think so. I don't want to swear to it, but I don't believe so. I believe we did this simply on the strength of the property value. It's commercial property. It's on Route 4. They like the location. They felt that it would fly very easily.
No further questions.
Okay. Attorney Fossey, do you have any?
No, sir.
Okay. I have a couple. Did you have legal counsel throughout this entire process?
No.
With Mr. Farrell? Are you familiar with the law firm of Gould & Burke?
I am now.
Were you then?
They did actually introduce me to Mr. Burke. Scott introduced me to him. He came up and shook my hand and told me that they would take care of all of the paperwork that needed to be done, yes.
Did they give you any indication that they were representing your interests in any way?
No. He just told me that they represented Scott.
Do you know who produced the legal documents that you indicated you signed? And
I would say it would have been Mr. Burke, because he had one of the girls from his office come with me and show me where to sign and what it was.
Did they explain to you what these documents were?
They said they were going to be used for lenders that they would find. That was pretty much when I realized that it wasn't Scott Farah himself or his company that I was borrowing from. They were acting as a front for these individual lenders.
Do you have any knowledge whether or not this $1,200,000 was fully funded by lenders?
I do.
And what's your knowledge of that?
My knowledge is it was, yes. Because I have documents that show that each lot at $45,000 was done by either one lender or by two lenders, or in some instances one lender would do three lots, and there was paperwork that was done and signed for by the individuals. Since they went south, I have been contacted by many of these individuals and asked if we could work it out some way so that they didn't lose their money. And I said, I have no problem with that if they can wait for the economy, but it's the bankruptcy court that may have a problem for us with that.
How did you get notified of the involvement of the United States Bankruptcy Court?
I was notified by mail.
And if you recall, from whom did you receive notification?
I would assume it would have to be the, once again, I don't recall per se, but it would have to be the lawyers that are acting as the trustees, which would be Nottinger I can't remember the other fellow's name, but.
Okay.
Is the Gatchell mortgage still in existence?
It is. And we're in court, or will be in court shortly, to try to put it back into first place.
Did your first mortgage holder of Concord commercial credit get paid off at some point?
It did.
And subsequent to the payoff of commercial credit, Gatchell either agreed to subordinate in some fashion, is that correct?
That's correct. Part of the monies that were received from the lenders were used to pay off that mortgage.
So the total indebtedness, if I were to look at recorded documents in the Registry of Deeds and read the amounts off the mortgage instruments, would be $1,525,000, is that correct?
Not for the penny, but I would say it's in that vicinity, okay. Yes.
And of that, $330,000 has gone into infrastructure.
That's correct.
And some other amount has gone to payment of interest. Is that correct?
That's correct. Let me be more clear, though. The Gatchell's money that they put in before we went to Scott Farrer was over a period of 2 years and was utilized by myself. So that can't be involved with that.
I understand that.
Okay.
I understand that. But that sum is represented by the $325,000 now second mortgage.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, no, I fully understand that. I'm just trying to get a picture of
how much is on the property.
The total documentary indebtedness on the property and what exists.
Okay.
Okay. I think I have that picture. I also understand that the $1,200,000 through FRM CLNM was fully funded by lenders.
Correct. That's correct.
I have nothing further. I want to thank Mr. Austin. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
And we're going. It's 1:30. We're back on the record. This is Charles Chandler, presiding officer in the FRM hearing, so called. It's January 5th, 2011. We have as a witness this afternoon, and before we get to that witness, any preliminary matters? Anything?
No, sir. I did review the banking website. We spoke about this off the record, but I did review the banking website at your suggestion to see if the banking examinations were there. I need to look a little bit further, but for now I can only tell you for sure that 2005, 2006, and 2007 examination reports are on the banking website. There's an FRM link from their
But we looked, we were looking for the 2004, and you're going to continue to look for that?
I will continue to look for that and have an update for you on Friday.
Thank you. There being no other preliminary matters, our first witness for this afternoon will be Mr. Lawrence Baldy. Mr. Baldy, as you may or may not know, this is an open public hearing. It is being recorded, and all testimony will be under oath. Are you willing to testify under oath?
Yes.
Okay. Would you raise your right hand, please? You solemnly swear the testimony you're about to give in the matter now pending will be the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth, so help you God.
Yes, I do.
And for the record, would you restate your name, spelling your last name.
Lawrence Baldy, B-A-L-D-I.
Mr. Baldy, as I have mentioned to every person who has testified, with a few exceptions, witnesses many times have a prepared statement they'd like to read into the record, and on other instances they would like to offer extemporaneously an opening statement if they will. You're under no requirement to do either. If you have a written statement, you can read it into the record. If you would like to speak extemporaneously as an opening statement, you may. If not, we'll proceed directly into question.
You can proceed.
Okay. Mr. Spill.
Mr. Baldy, where do you reside?
I reside at Weirs Beach.
Okay, and is that That's in New Hampshire, right?
Yes.
How long have you lived in Boyers Beach?
20 years.
Okay. When did you first come to know Scott Fair and Financial Resources?
In 1993.
What is your profession?
I was in the amusement business and a developer.
And when you say developer, do you mean real estate development?
Yes. Building houses and real estate development.
Can you tell us what your skills are in the real estate development business?
I've built houses, primarily modular homes, from the mid, around 2004, 2005, through 2009.
What is a modular home?
Modular home comes 90% pre-done. Everything is built in the factory.
Is there a particular company that you dealt with to acquire those homes?
I dealt with a company in Pennsylvania, Pleasant Valley Modular Homes.
And the particular homes that you were purchasing, what was the price range?
Around $100,000 for a house.
And what was the style of the home?
They could be ranch, capes, colonials. They had a wide range that you could pick from.
Let's go back to 1993. You said you were first introduced to Scott Fair?
Yes.
And how did that come about?
I needed to borrow some money to acquire a commercial piece of property. And I went to Financial Resources, and he was able to get the money.
What was the name of the commercial property?
Weir's Beach Water Slide.
You still own that property?
No, I do not.
When did you stop owning that property?
Last January.
Did you sell that property?
It was foreclosed.
Did you run the water slide from the time that you owned it?
Yes, I did.
Can you briefly tell us what that entailed?
It was a summer business. We were open 3 months a year, and it was tourist-oriented. People would come up and buy tickets and spend the day with us.
And in the rest of the year, not the summer months, how did you earn your income?
I didn't need to. I made enough in the summer. I didn't have to make anything in the winter.
How did you spend your time occupationally?
I was dabbling in doing developments, researching it, trying to get into the building.
At some point, did you become a development partner with Scott Fair?
Yes, in 2005, I believe it was.
Prior to that time, did you develop real estate on your own?
No, okay. I did not.
Were you involved in the real estate business?
Yes, I would help friends build houses and things on a volunteer.
Would you sell modular homes?
No.
So is it fair to say that when you became partners or business associates with Scott Fair, that was the time that you got into the modular home business?
Yeah, I had approached Scott. I needed to borrow some money to buy a display home. I had become a modular home dealer. I wanted to buy a display home. Went to him to try to borrow some money. And when he found out I was a modular home dealer, he suggested that we do developments together.
And how would you sell the modular homes?
If an individual wanted a house, I could sell them a house for their land, or I would also have land available that we could sell them with a house on it.
Was the land that you had available, land that you owned, was Scott Fair's
yes.
business interests?
Yes, it was.
Okay. The homes that were not sold with land that you had access to, was that done with Scott Fair or on your own?
I don't understand the question.
In other words, if someone owned their own property and you sold them a home, was that done with Scott Fair or on your own?
No, that would be done on my own.
Okay. Were you earning an income when you sold the modular home to the individual who owned his own property?
Yes, I would.
How would you make the income?
We would add it to the purchase price of the house.
Okay. Did you make an income when you did home sales with Scott Farrow?
No, I did not.
Okay. Did you earn any income when you did home sales in real estate development with Scott Farrow?
No, the income was going to come at the end of each project. When a project was complete was when we were going to have some income.
Were you partners with Scott Farrow?
I believe I was partners with Susan Ferreira, but Scott was definitely involved.
Who is Susan Ferreira?
His wife.
And you said you started your combined business with Scott Farrow around 2004, 2005?
Yes.
When did you first meet Susan Farrow?
I met Susan Farrow approximately a year after we were doing a project together.
Okay, so...
About 2006.
That sounds confusing. How could you be in business with someone you'd never met?
Exactly. I really feel I was in business with Scott, but he had it where I was in business with her.
Why did he do that?
I have no idea.
Okay, how did he set it up so that you were in business with Susan Farrow?
He did all the legal paperwork. He did all the trust documents. That was all done through Scott.
And how was Susan Farrow involved in the trust? Was she a trustee?
I believe she was a trustee in most cases.
Okay. And who are the beneficiaries of these trusts?
I believe in most cases it was myself and Susan.
What was the first real estate development project that you did with Scott Farrow?
We did a project on Colonial Drive in Moultonboro. In Cook Lane in Moultonboro.
So what was Cook Lane?
It was a 5-unit subdivision, and we did the infrastructure, put the wells in, and completed 2 houses.
Did you own the property for that development?
Yes, that was part of the trust. The trust owned the property.
Was the trust LBSF?
Yes, it was.
The LB being yourself and the SF being Susan Farrow?
Yes.
How did you acquire the money to purchase the land?
Scott handled all the finances. I was strictly the builder.
Okay. Were there various lenders that put money into this project?
I believe so. I don't really know how that end of it worked.
But you signed the paperwork?
I signed the paperwork.
Okay. And how much indebtedness was there on Cook Lane?
As a rough idea, I would say about $200,000 per lot.
And how much was spent on the infrastructure that you know of?
Boy, it was a long time ago. I believe around $750,000. No.
Okay.
Maybe $500,000.
And who did the infrastructure?
The infrastructure was done by Eric Newhouse.
Was anything ever built on those lots?
We completed two houses. One was a colonial, one was a ranch.
And were those homes sold?
Yes, they were.
And who purchased those homes?
I believe it was Donald Dodge.
Do you know where the money came from to purchase those homes?
I do not.
Scott Farrow was, I think you've stated, responsible for the paperwork?
Yes.
So was he also responsible for the money?
Yes, Scott was responsible for all the documents, legal documents, and he handled all the money, the budgeting, anything to do with the money aspects, I would have to go to Scott. Scott would give me permission to do something on a project.
Can you describe that a little bit in more detail?
I would meet with Scott quite frequently, and he would tell me what on a project I could do. And I was under the impression that we were waiting for money to come in for a particular project, that all the money hadn't shown up yet. So it was always the lenders owed money.
Would projects stop and start?
Oh, absolutely.
How would that work?
He would tell me that we had to wait for money to show up, so he wanted me to proceed with another project or just take some time off and not do anything until money showed up.
And did you ever handle any of the money for these projects?
No. If I had an invoice from a contractor, I would submit that to Scott or CL&M, and they would write a check out. CL&M would write the check out and either mail it to them or hand it to me, and I would hand deliver it to the people.
Who is Tom Hawley?
Tom Hawley was an inspector for financial resources.
And by inspector, what do you mean by that?
He would check to make sure the work was done for the money being given out.
Was he inspecting on Cook Lane?
Yes, he was.
Walk us through a typical inspection that he did.
I wasn't part of it. I would go down, submit the bills at Financial Resources, and a few days later, I would have a check. So during that time period, Tom Hawley, I assume, would go out and check the property.
And who would the bills be submitted to?
In the beginning, I would submit them to Scott.
And then did that change?
About 2000... In 2008, I started submitting them to CL&M, Don Dodge.
Do you know why that was changed?
I do not.
Was it Scott that told you to change that?
Yes, Scott told me to stop bringing the things up to Don's office.
Bring what thing?
The paperwork.
Well, what happened to Tom Hawley?
Tom Hawley was no longer part of the inspection process at that point for me. Even when Tom Hawley was part of the inspection process, I never submitted anything to Tom Hawley. That was something that Scott would have had Tom go out and do, I assume.
But so the bills will go to either Scott or Don?
Yes.
And those bills are paid, to your knowledge?
Oh, yes. Very rarely did I have any problems. When Scott gave me the go-ahead to do a particular project, when I submitted the bills, we would get paid immediately.
The legal work?
All the legal work was done in the Burke and Gould's office.
Who was Burke and Gould?
They were two lawyers. Down in the basement of Financial Resources.
Okay. Did you attend the various loan closings?
No, I don't believe I was ever at a loan closing. I would sign documents, but the loans would have already been closed or closed after I signed the paperwork. Okay.
So someone would present you with paperwork to sign, and then the closing would take place?
I believe that was the way.
After Cook Lane, was there a subsequent project?
After Cook Lane, I took over a single unit lot in Guilford that Scott had started with somebody else, and he asked me to complete it.
And did you complete it?
And I completed it.
And then what did you do?
And then from there, we went to Lilac Valley and started that. We completed the infrastructure in phase one. It was a three-phase project. The infrastructure in phase one was done. We put a display home in and then had the realtor try to sell houses.
Who was the realtor?
Ron Fidette, Keller Williams.
Okay. Did you sell any houses at Lilac Valley?
He sold one house, yes.
How many unit subdivision was Lilac Valley?
A 60 unit.
Okay. I think you said it was going to be done in phases?
Yes.
What was the infrastructure for the first phase?
The first phase infrastructure was about $250,000, between $250,000 and $300,000.
Was there engineering costs?
The engineering, there was minor engineering costs when I had control of the project. The bulk of the engineering was done before I had control of the project. And I had seen a bill for that, and it had exceeded $500,000 for the engineering on that project.
Who was involved in getting the engineering done for that project?
I believe it was Gary Coyne.
Was there any infrastructure done for phases 2 and 3?
None of the infrastructure was done for 2 and 3, with the exception of snow fence was put up on phase 1 and 2.
What infrastructure was done for phase 1?
The water, the sewer, the roads, the trees, telephone, power, was all done.
And that was $250,000?
Yes.
Do you know how much indebtedness was placed on Lilac Valley?
I do not.
How did you own that property?
That was in a trust. I believe I was in partners with Susan Ferreira on that one. And I believe I was a trustee.
Was that the Lilac Valley Real Estate Trust?
Lilac Valley Real Estate Trust.
Do you know who Harry Bean is?
Harry Bean was one of the lenders. I found out after Financial Resources closed the doors.
How did you find out that Harry Bean was one of the lenders?
I believe I was notified of that legally at some point.
Do you know how much money Mr. Bean put into Lilac Valley?
I believe it was around $2 million.
How do you know that?
I believe at one point I saw a check with Harry Bean's name on it.
Would that have been after the collapse of the business?
After the collapse of Financial Resources.
Okay, do you know where that check went?
I do not. I believe it was deposited into an account controlled by Donald Dodge, Lilac Valley. The check was made out to Lilac Valley, and I believe Donald Dodge controlled a trust that was Lilac Valley Investment Trust, and I had control of Lilac Valley Realty Trust.
Okay, so you think it was deposited into a different trust?
I believe so.
Okay. Were there any other Lilac Valley trusts?
Not as far as I know. I didn't even know that there was a second one until after Financial Resources closed.
Was Lilac Valley going to be a land ownership project or leased ownership?
Lilac Valley was a lease project. The people buying the homes would have a 99-year lease.
And how many units were actually put on Lilac Valley?
A total of 3.
Did those units sell?
Only one of them did.
What happened to the other two?
One was a display home, and the other one was being leased.
Do you know what the cost was to place those homes on those lots?
Approximately $120,000. It was including the cost of the house.
And you know what the sales price was on the one home?
I believe it was $189,000 is what Keller Williams was trying to sell them for.
At some point, you determined that the total indebtedness that you signed for these various real estate projects, correct?
Yes.
Do you know what the total number was?
It was somewhere around $8 million.
Okay. The other project we haven't yet talked about, and we'll get to that, is Colonial Drive, right?
Yes.
And that was after Lilac Valley?
Lilac Valley was still going on during from the time that we started the project to Financial Resources to close the doors.
Now, do you think $8 million, it's fairly obvious that $8 million didn't get spent on those three projects.
No,
right?
Not even close.
Cook Lane, Colonial Drive, and Lilac Valley.
No.
Do you know where the money went?
I have no idea. At the time, I didn't know that we had the $8 million in the account.
So you weren't keeping track of the indebtedness that you were signing for?
No.
And why was that?
Scott handled all the money.
Did you trust Scott Ferrer?
I totally trusted Scott Ferrer.
I mean, when you say that, the word trust has a meaning, but you say it with, and I'm getting the feeling that it was quite a high regard.
Yeah, it was. It was a very high regard. I thought Scott was very reputable. At that point, I'd known Scott for almost 20 years, I guess.
Is that the way other people saw him and held him in high regard?
From talking to people, people either trusted him or hated him. There was no in between.
Would you say more people trusted him and held him in high regard than hated him?
Yeah, I was around primarily the people that trusted him, so I didn't meet too many of the other people.
Name some of the other people that held him in high regard that you can off the top of your head.
I really felt Gary Coyne did. I felt Tom Hawley did. Rhonda, I don't know her last name. She was
Rhonda Babby?
Yes.
Any others that you can think of off the top of your head?
Oh, Don Dodge. Don Dodge would always talk very well with Scott whenever I would meet with Don.
Robert Ferrer? Robert Ferrer is the father?
Yeah. I didn't meet Robert Ferrer a whole lot. I've met him a few times, and we never really talked about Scott.
You met him a few times?
Yes.
Well, you were involved with developing the what they call the church property, Colonial Drive.
Yes.
When you did that, did you run into Robert Ferrer?
Very rarely.
Was he involved in developing that property?
Not when I was involved with it. He might come over and see how we were doing once in a while, but I didn't see him on a regular basis.
Was the ownership of that property placed in your name?
I believe most of it were in trust. Most of the parcels were in various trusts.
Trust that were in your name.
Yes. Yes. Okay.
Describe events at Colonial Drive, if you could, in terms of how that project was handled.
Well, Colonial Drive came to me in the early summer of 2009, and Scott wanted me to put houses on it, and it was a relatively rushed job. He had all the houses sold, so he wanted me to hurry up and get them on, so we were working as fast as money became available.
When you say he wanted you to hurry up, how would we convey that to you?
We wanted to have the project underway immediately, and he wanted to go as fast as I could. He wanted me to get people working on it.
And what was built on Colonial Drive?
We moved a lot of dirt and put in two foundations and in one house all set for delivery.
Was it anything ever built from the ground up?
No, not from me. There were two house lots in Colonial Drive that were there before I took it over that I believe Tom Hawley was the contractor on, and he built those from ground up. I had nothing to do with those.
How many lot subdivision was Colonial Drive?
I want to say 13 or 14, but I don't believe that I had control of all the lots. I don't really know how many lots I had control of.
Now, when you said you had one house for delivery, can you describe that for us?
It was a four-bedroom ranch.
Was that a modular home?
It was a modular home, yes.
Were the other two built by Holly Modular?
Excuse me?
The other two that were built by Holly, were they modular?
No. Holly built them from ground up, stick-built.
Okay, the four-bedroom ranch was in the process of being delivered?
Yes, we were going to take delivery on the beginning of the week, and on Friday of the previous week is when Scott closed the doors.
Okay, so how did you handle that situation?
I called the company on Friday and told them not to deliver the house. I didn't know what was going on at that point. But I didn't want them to send a house up where I had no check to pay for it.
And after the business collapsed, did you speak to anybody?
Pleasant Valley? Or
anybody associated with Financial Resources?
I've seen some people in some of the grocery stores and everything as I've shopped, and I did, after Financial Resources closed, Gary Coins called me a few times. And I've seen the lawyers a couple of times after Financial Resources closed, and I believe that was it.
Do you recall a phone call from Robert Farah?
Yes, I did get a phone call from Robert Farah. I believe that was on Friday, or maybe Monday. And he told me to hang on, that everything was going to be okay. Scott was going to fix everything. He was passing on a message.
Passing on a message from
whom? From Scott.
You know how much money was tied up in Lilac Valley?
No, I do not.
Do you know how much money was tied up in Colonial Drive?
No. I didn't handle the finances. Scott would handle the finances.
How would you describe the lots up on Colonial Drive?
The lots in Colonial Drive are very nice. They all have city sewer. They're big. Colonial Drive is a nice project.
Do you know how much was spent on infrastructure at Colonial Drive?
No, because that was done before I got involved.
What would you say at the time you were working there was the value of the lots?
I would say around $100,000 a lot. They're nice lots.
What were the homes going to sell for?
$250,000 to $300,000.
Can you describe the difference between Colonial Drive and Cook Lane in terms of geographic location?
Cook Lane is about 3 miles away from Colonial Drive. Cook Lane was in a wetter location. It was more moisture. The water table was about 3 feet below the ground. Colonial Drive had real nice drainage. Colonial Drive was also the only piece of real estate in Moultonboro that had city sewer. All the other properties in Moultonboro have septic tanks. This Colonial Drive was just on the border of the next town, and that town had city sewer.
That town was Santa Harbor?
Yes, Santa Harbor. So Colonial Drive was a real nice piece of property because that was the only piece that you could get city sewer and still live in Moultonboro.
Can you describe Mr. Coyne for us in terms of how he would be involved in these various projects?
I had very little to do with Gary. He always had grandiose ideas on doing projects. He was always a happy person. upbeat. But no, I had very little to do with Gary. Scott was dealing mainly with Gary on these projects.
At some point, did you give money to CLNF, your own personal money?
Yeah. I had taken out a loan on a piece of property that I had, and I believe the dollar amount was $400,000 or $500,000 that CLNM had to of my money.
Was that the water slide?
Yes.
And how did you get the $400,000 from the water slide?
Scott put a second mortgage on it.
And you handed that money to CLNM?
Yes.
Why did you do that?
To speed the projects up. All the projects were waiting on lenders, and I wanted to get these projects going, so we were trying to free some money up so we could do them. And CLNM would take care of writing out the checks, as they would manage the money.
And when did you do that?
I believe that was done in 2008, in the fall of 2008.
Did you get the sense that CLNM was cash-strapped and they needed money from you?
No, not at all. Not at all. The only reason why I did that was so that we could get the extra funds so that I could get these projects going on my end, so I wouldn't have to wait for the lenders to come up with the money.
So was it your idea?
No, it was Scott's idea, but I thought it was a good idea.
Who was the lender that gave you money against the water slide?
I don't remember.
Was it a private individual?
I believe it was one person. I believe it was a private individual. I just can't remember his name.
Would you say that amount matched the value of the water slide at the time you took out the loan?
I didn't think it did. But there again, I left that off to Scott.
So you thought it was more than the value?
Oh, no. I thought the value was greater than that.
What did you think the value was?
Well, I had an appraisal done from an appraisal company, nothing to do with financial resources. I believe the appraisal was $2.1 million.
What was the total indebtedness, including the $400,000?
$900,000.
When it was foreclosed on, do you know how much it sold for?
$580,000.
And that was in 2010?
Yes.
And I assume because of the collapse of financial resources, that also created financial problems for yourself.
Absolutely.
And would you mind describing that for us briefly?
Well, my problem was on the water slide. I had an additional $500,000 note that there was no way I could pay for it. That money was gone. So my bread and butter was gone.
Are you currently employed?
Right now I'm not. I'm in the process of going bankrupt. I've been doing that for a few months. So until that's done and behind me, I'm not working anywhere, not doing anything.
Mr. Forster, you'll have some questions for us.
Okay.
Eric Forster, State of New Hampshire. Did you ever maintain an office at 1503 Drive?
Yes, I did.
Can you briefly explain to me what happened at the closure of FRM around, I think, November 6/09? Did you go down to the office? What did you see? Give me the atmosphere that day.
The general feeling was all the people that were there were very surprised that this was happening, couldn't believe it, and they were just very upset.
So you went down after you heard of the closure, I assume after the phone call from Mr. Farah,
yes.
Scott's father. Did you go to clean out your belongings? Is that the reason you went?
I went down to the side to get my stuff. I had an awful lot of paperwork there. I had just recently moved in. The scout wanted me to move in so that I was closer to do these projects, so he could reach me easier. So I moved all my paperwork and everything up there. I had a lot. I had done that. I think about the 1st of September, I started moving in. And I really wasn't even fully up there yet when the doors shut down.
Were any other members of your family involved with developing or even lending to FRM? Or was it just yourself?
No, just myself.
The reason I say that is you just vaguely remember someone referring to yourself as the Baldy brothers. Is it the brother?
I don't have a brother.
No, okay. I just thought in my head. I have no further questions.
I have a few, Mr. Baldy.
Okay.
I've listened to your answers to Attorney Spill about your business relationship with Mr. Farrar, Scott Farrar. I'm interested in that. Did you have any kind of a formal partnership agreement with him regarding proceeds from any particular project?
Only the trust documents was all that I had. I guess everything else was verbal.
Who prepared the trust documents?
I believe it was done in Mike Burke and Mike Gould's office.
Did you consider them to be your attorneys?
Yeah. Yeah, I did.
And to me, this is fairly important. Did anyone in the office of Gould and Burke ever explain to you the duties and responsibilities of a trustee of a trust?
No.
The documents were prepared and given to you and somebody would say, sign them?
Yes. Yes.
And there was never an explanation?
No, I don't believe so.
And you'd sign them?
Yeah, I would sign them.
Why were you comfortable signing them?
I trusted Scott. It was crazy. I'll never do it again.
So my understanding is you have some kind of an unarticulated relationship with Scott Farrar where you're functioning as a prime contractor in project developments, and at some point you as an individual were to draw an income from these projects.
Yes.
Did you ever draw an income from these projects?
No. The income was going to come at the completion of these projects. And I also looked at this whole thing as being, kind of going to college and trying to learn how to do this. And as the economy got better, and as the experience got better, I figured there'd be more opportunities.
What did you expect as your share of the profits?
Every project would be different. It would depend on how good a job we did building the projects and how much we were able to sell them for.
How did you know what percentage you might receive without some kind of a formal written relationship with Mr. Farrar?
I didn't. Well, no, we were going to split the profit 50-50. So I didn't know that.
And yet you didn't keep track of the books in any way, is that correct?
No, all the books were up there.
Okay.
Yeah.
So who was going to determine what was 50-50 of what?
Well, I figured he was honest.
Did you ever ask Gould and Burke to explain any of those trust documents to you?
No, I never did.
Have you ever been a trustee of a trust before?
No.
Have you ever employed an attorney to do any work for you, other than Guldenberg?
Yes, I've had attorneys.
Okay.
Yes.
You didn't think to take these documents to them to say, what do you think of this?
No, I didn't think to do that.
And please correct me if I'm wrong, but my understanding is that at some point in time, from all these projects in which you were involved, that you became aware that $8 million had been advanced by lenders through CL&M or FR&M for these projects. Is that a fair statement? Do I understand that correctly?
No, I became aware of that after the doors closed and after my attorney started finding out what I had signed for and what I owned. And that's when I found out how much money was actually...
Oh, I understand it was after the fact.
Yes.
After the collapse,
yes,
if you will. But that figure has been represented to you, and you find that to be a credible figure.
Yes, okay. I do.
Who foreclosed on your water slide?
Laconia Savings Bank.
So Laconia Savings was first?
Yes.
And CL&M or FRM was second?
Yes.
Which was second? Which entity? Do you remember?
Yeah, Laconia Savings was first.
And who was second?
I do not know. It was whoever loaned the additional $400,000 or $500,000.
So that $400,000 came to you, $400,000 or $500,000. That's quite a differential.
It never actually came to me. I signed the paperwork, and the check went right to CL&M.
Oh, I understand that.
Okay.
Well, I believe it. But it came to you, nevertheless.
Okay.
Okay. So you don't, or I'm not going to tell you what you do or don't know. Do you know the source of the funds for the funding of that second mortgage?
No, I do not.
Is it fair to say that now, having been foreclosed, having lost your primary source of livelihood, you have subsequently received a demand from the United States Bankruptcy Court for funds? Is that correct?
Well, I filed for bankruptcy.
Have you received anything aside from your filing from the United States Bankruptcy Court?
I don't believe so.
Okay.
I don't believe so.
And yet, if I were to look at the records of Belknap County Registry of Deeds, I would find that you are indebted to either FRM or CL&M in the tune of $400,000 to $500,000. Is that correct?
I don't know how the thing was structured. I do not know. If it would show that I owe it to CL&M, I would doubt I would owe it to CL&M.
But you borrowed the money and it hasn't been paid back.
I borrowed the money, yes.
Okay.
Yes.
And there weren't sufficient funds at the foreclosure of the water slide to pay off Laconia Savings Bank and whatever entity to whom you owed the money for the second.
Right, right.
And so there was a deficiency.
Yes.
And the deficiency, correct, based on what you told me, is the sum of the second plus a portion of the first. If you owed $1 million to Laconia and they foreclosed for $580,000,
yeah, I believe it was $900,000 altogether on the water slide, and I believe Laconia Savings Bank was paid off in full.
Oh, were they?
Okay. I believe so. Yes.
Did you get an accounting of that foreclosure?
My attorneys probably did. Okay. I haven't seen one.
Do you know if any of the sums from the foreclosure went to either FRM or CL&M or the United States Bankruptcy Court?
I don't know where the funds went.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay. In any event, the result of this is you filed for personal bankruptcy.
Yes.
Are unemployed.
Yes.
And I have nothing further.
I do have some follow-up questions.
Please follow up.
Thank you. Mr. Baldy, were you involved with some other properties that you didn't develop through CLNS?
There was a project in New Hampton, 4 or 5 units.
That's good.
That I discovered that I had purchased in the fall of 2009. And then I believe there were 2 lots in Alton Bay.
How did you come to own these properties without having any real involvement?
This was all something that I had signed in the office of the lawyers through Scott.
Were you aware that you were signing for a property that you were not developing?
Oh, no. The intention was to develop these. He definitely wanted me to develop New Hampton. That was something that he wanted me to get right down there and get working on it.
Was that one of those instances that you previously described as an instance where the money had not, quote, arrived yet?
Exactly. But it was due in any day, and I was going to start the project any day.
Looking back on it, do you now believe that Mr. Farrer was lying when he said that money was there or not there?
Yes, definitely.
How do you understand that now?
Through the documents that I have seen since this thing, I found out that all the lenders had paid everything in full. And had I known that, these projects would have been done. If I had had access to that money, Lilac Valley was a great project. It could have been done for the amount of money that was borrowed on it. And it could have been done before the economy actually turned real bad, and it could have made some money.
Did you find that you were being moved around by Scott Farrer to, based on what he believed to be the immediate need?
I'm assuming that to be the case now, that he wanted me to move around for that, to keep everything working. At the time, it made sense because I thought the money was being, the money wasn't available until the lenders gave it to us. So we had to stop a project and start another one.
So it's possible that the money was available when you began the project, but then became unavailable.
Exactly. In hindsight, that's probably what happened.
So it's possible he was moving money around to different projects.
Yeah. But there again, that's only hearsay. I don't really know.
So with respect to the signing aspect of this, where you were signing documents, would he represent to you at that time whether money was there or not?
No, we never talked about that. When I would sign something, I would come in and see Scott at some point during the day, and he would tell me there's some documents for me to sign downstairs. So I would go down and sign the documents.
With respect to Lilac Valley, we calculated that somewhere in the close to $4 million was indebted to that property or attached to that property in the form of loans. And you've described $250,000 that was spent for infrastructure and another few $100,000 to build 2 or 3 modular homes, correct?
Yes.
Do you have any idea where the balance of that money went?
I have no idea at all. No idea. I never saw it.
With respect to the interest that was paid on the various loans, was interest being paid at the time?
Not by me. In hindsight, I believe it to be what it was being done through CLNM. But I didn't handle the money. Scott handled the money. Aspect of it. I didn't know he was making interest payments all these times.
You got involved in Lilac Valley in about, was it 2008?
I believe it was 2008.
Okay. And you were out of there to do Colonial Drive in 2009, right?
Yes.
So you were there for about a year?
I believe it was about a year. Yeah. It might have been 2007, but I believe it took it over in 2008.
And why was it that you were moved out of Lilac Valley?
We were waiting for money to become available so we could start another phase.
That's what Scott told you?
Yes.
That the money wasn't there yet?
Right. We had to cross a bridge. We had to cross a river with a bridge, and that was going to be about $150,000 to do phase two. And that was really what the big holdup was, waiting for that big check to come in so we could do the bridge.
I have no further questions.
Can I just ask one or two questions? Sir. With respect to the second mortgage on a water slide, when did that occur? What year and month, roughly?
I believe it was 2008.
After
fall
that,
of 2008.
Fall of 2008?
Yeah.
After that time, that should have solved any problems, or at least some of them, when you asked Scott why you weren't going on to the next phase, because you had now given $500,000.
Yes.
So were the excuses of money not being there from lenders still being used after?
Well, we were chewing up my money to do the projects from that point on.
So at some point did he tell you that not only had they used up what you had given, but they were still waiting on additional money from lenders?
No, I don't think he ever, I don't think that ever, he had me pretty busy. I was going all the time doing things, so at that point we were going about as fast as we could go.
Nothing further. Thank you.
I have a couple final questions. During this whole process and these projects you described to Attorney Spill and Attorney Forcier, you never took a draw of any kind?
No, I did not.
You were sufficiently comfortable living off the operation of the water slide?
Absolutely.
So you could do this?
Absolutely.
Okay. Now, were you ever a co-trustee with Gary Coyne in any trust?
Not as far as I know. I don't believe so. I've never seen any documents to say I was.
Can you tell me about your New Hampton?
About my what?
About the New Hampton project you described. Did you describe the New Hampton project here?
Yeah, I found out about the New Hampton project after Financial Resources closed. No, I'm sorry. New Hampton I knew about. Alton Bay I found out about after Financial Resources closed.
I'm interested in New Hampton.
I had never been to the New Hampton property at all. It was something that came to the table sometime in the fall, probably in October, maybe September of 2009. And it was a project that Scott wanted me to get going on as soon as I had Colonial Drive, a couple of houses of Colonial Drive, more under control.
He wanted is it your understanding that you had title to property in New Hampton?
Yes. I thought I had a couple of lots in New Hampton in September or October.
And is it your understanding that you had title as a trustee or co-trustee of a trust?
I thought it was a trustee. I thought it was something to do with Susan Ferreira again. In me. I don't believe Gary Coyne was ever part of any of my projects, but I could be wrong.
Okay. Did you ever actually occupy space at 15 Northview Drive?
Yes.
Did you pay any rent or fees or charges?
No, not at all. It was not my idea to move up there. Scott wanted me to be up there so it would be closer to everything, so I was in the process of moving my office up.
Did you ever question him as to why you were going to be a trustee in these trusts?
I was doing the building. I mean, you know, that was how I was securing my 50% share.
Was that spelled out in the trust agreements, if you recall?
I didn't read the trust agreements. I believe it was. I believe I've read the original one, which is Cook Lane, and I believe in Cook Lane, I think it was spelled out that way.
Do you ever recall signing documents called trustees' certificates?
I don't. I don't remember.
Okay. I have nothing further.
Nothing further. Okay.
I have nothing further. Thank you, Mr. Baldwin. Thank you very much.
All right.
Thank you. Is there anything else you
deserve?
Thanks.
Okay. Thanks. You're free to go. Thank you.
Not at this time.
Okay. I'm going to close the hearing.